I mean, Muhammad's conviction is that there was a conspiracy. I mean, he has a whole history of, you know, knowing Diana and her family. Diana had confided in him that, you know, she feared for her life and this sort of thing. I mean, he believes firmly still that there was a conspiracy. He hasn't had access to the British intelligence files. We haven't had answers, you know, to who was driving the Fiat Uno, why Maury Poole had carbon monoxide in his blood, ridiculous amount that he wouldn't have been able to walk if he hadn't, so on. There are all these unanswered questions.
Mohammed is a grieving father who wants the answers. He has the resources and the will to get them.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's minutes past five. Sorry about that, folks. A lot of rearranging in the studio to do here. And it's welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 8th of March 2024, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, and on radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please don't use the Google Play Store. Use Aurora. In fact, you can, if you've got an Android phone, you can install Aurora and get all the original apps rather than the ones that Google filters in the Play Store. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its propaganda psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes. Not just here in Bristol and Britain, but around the world. What we'll be doing today is looking at all sorts of, well, particularly navigating the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution and the Fourth Reich Matrix. Who knows where we're going to head tonight? But joining me in the studio is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. I've also got freelance journalist from Bristol, Joe Banks, and Green councillor in Bristol for Central Ward, Annie Stafford Townsend. So, as it's International Women's Day, you're actually popping off, Annie, aren't you, after we finish, to do something in the city centre about this?
Yeah, there's a Women for Palestine. There's a Women for Palestine march at Castle Park from 6. So I'm going to go along to that.
Well, that's a bit of an anti-Semitic statement. Women for Palestine. Now, I know it's a very mean thing to say, but people have been saying the same about me. What do you make of the Palestine, whole Palestine Gaza business?
I think that there's innocent civilians being hurt and caught up in this, and that's why we need an immediate ceasefire.
Well, 30,000 killed. Never mind just hurt. Mm. We do need an immediate ceasefire. Why do you think there hasn't been one? And do you think the Brits are in any position to push for one? I mean, what's the point of us saying it?
I think the UK has got a very strong place on the international stage, and therefore the things that we call for has a huge amount of power. So, yes, it is what we should be calling for.
And why aren't we?
You have to ask Rishi Sunak that, but Green Party policy is, and the Green Party have been very clear right from the offset, right from when it first happened in October, have been calling for a ceasefire right from the beginning. So we've always been really clear on our stance.
Well, it's good to get that out of the way. I've been accused by the campaign against anti-Semitism this week of being an anti-Semite. I just ignore these things nowadays. I don't think there's any point in suing these people, because in a way I had several messages on different systems saying this is a badge of honour, Tony, but of course I'm not anti-Semitic. I just make a big difference between the state of Israel and the Jewish faith, the Jewish religion, and the people who were persecuted in World War II are not the same people now running Israel by any means. So let's just talk a bit about Bristol politics. Now we've got off the world stage, because your party's looking set to take the city over potentially in May. What do you think your chances are?
I think our chances are looking quite good, and I think the city of Bristol and people here are looking for something different. We've had a predominantly Labour-led administration for the last four decades. It would be quite good for Bristol to have something different, and I think now is the time for the Greens to demonstrate how we could do things differently and how it doesn't need to be like it is. It could hopefully be something different, something more positive.
Well, I think everyone wants different when they go to the ballot box, don't they? But what indications are you that the Greens might win in May?
Well, we've got our data. We've got the fact that we are the largest group on council at the moment. Obviously, under a mayoral model, we aren't the party of opposition, of administration. We are the party of opposition instead. And even in our position as opposition, we've still managed to get some positive changes through the council. And we were highly... So a committee system, which is what we're switching to in May, is Green Party policy. That's what we advocated for, and that's what we got our administrative model switched to.
Actually, it was the Lib Dems, was the old council leader. Well, I shouldn't call her the old council, it sounds mean. But she was a previous council leader, Barbara Jank, in the House of Lords, that actually got the law changed to allow for the referendum. The Lib Dems really pushed for this, but it seems like you're the ones to benefit from it.
Well, we worked collaboratively with them, which is what we need to do under a committee system with all other parties. The Lib Dems favoured a leader and cabinet model, which is what they had previously. Green Party policy is for a committee working model, which is what we advocated for, and that's what we got as part of our sort of pushing the Lib Dems to advocate eventually for a committee model rather than a leader and cabinet, because a leader and cabinet is really no different than a mayor model. And so by sort of scrapping the mayor and going for a leader and cabinet, it'll be frying pan fire. So that's why we advocated for a committee system. It's why Green Party policy advocates for committee systems, because it's a much more inclusive way of representing politics in a city, because it's a very diverse city and it isn't represented by any one party, and it never can be. And we need that plurality of view being represented within the administration and the way in which you run the council in order to make sure that it is a city for everybody, not just the viewpoint of one particular party.
Okay, so the Lib Dems started the process, but you put your weight in behind it, is that fair?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, right. So when it comes to policies, we covered your over the Christmas period, and there was a debacle in one of the Development Control Committee meetings, and then there was also following that a full council meeting. I was absolutely shocked to hear both the mayor and I think he was the housing guy or the planning guy, Tom Renard, thank you. So thanks, Joe, chipping in. That actually discussing a complaint against you in full council. Now, I mean, anyone that's everybody involved in running any kind of big organisation, council, business, I mean, as I was in a housing association, you just simply understand that once a complaint is started, there's a confidential process. I was shocked to hear the mayor and Tom Renard both in the full council meeting discussing details of your complaint. So this does suggest that there's a bit of a deficit in governance. Can you say something about what you think about the way that the council is being run in terms of governance? Because I think there's a lot of people around the city who are scratching their heads looking at this stuff, say, do these people really know what they're doing?
Yeah, so it was quite an unfortunate whole series of events. So Tom Renard is a leader of the Labour group and their pick for leader post May. What happened was a member of the public said something that was misheard after a planning committee meeting, was misheard by a councillor. She placed a complaint about that, but it only came in through the council processes after the Labour group posted about it on Twitter, calling for my resignation. And then it got repeated in full council. The thing is, in a complaint system, that a member puts in a complaint and it stays confidential. Now, if that had happened, if the member had put a complaint in and it remained confidential, then when the evidence of what had actually happened, which corrected the mishearing that the member had, then that would have all been solved quickly, gently, behind closed doors. All those misunderstandings could have been smoothed out. Everybody would have not been upset. The member of the public would have not been horrendously upset, and she still is. All of it would have been done, dusted before Christmas, it would have all been fine. But by making a political hoo-ha about it, it's been blown up into something much more harmful than it needed to be. And it's a complete mockery of the complaint system as well, because it goes against everything.
Well, you know what I was thinking at the time? I was thinking, if I were you, I'd be making a complaint against Marley Bennett and against the mayor for talking about something confidential in a full council meeting. But of course, I don't imagine
I couldn't
you
possibly
did that.
Comment on that.
No, but you didn't do that. But you see, this is the problem, isn't it? You often find that the people who just want to get on and do stuff don't make these little niggling complaints. But anyway, what do you think about generally about governance? And about the competence of the current team?
I think generally there is a conception or an understanding that complaints have never been upheld by the monitoring officer, who is the person who investigates all complaints. I mean, the complaint against me wasn't upheld. That has been dismissed as politically motivated. But I also know that complaints have been upheld towards councillors in the past as well, even though I was told complaints are never upheld. It feels like it's a little bit of a way of dissuading people from making complaints, because there's no point, because it's not going to be upheld.
Well, I mean,
anyway.
I've heard this from police officers that say, well, we made a complaint against X officer and then we were targeted. I mean, it's obviously a very important. It may be a more extreme version, Martin, but we've been hearing this week about Northern Ireland and Steak Knife and Frank Scappaticci, who was the, if you want, complaints officer for the IRA, although he was extremely, you know, this meant people would be executed. And the fact was that he was actually working for the other side. So this is an extremely. It's extremely important to get this right, is what I'm trying to say.
And it's also really important to that kind of concept in law of not, you know, innocent until proven guilty, and that has to also be part of a complaint system. It has to be confidential at the beginning part in order for proper investigations to take place, and then if somebody is found to be factual and the complaint is upheld, that's the point then potentially the result of it could be made public, and the ramifications of that, whichever, obviously depending on the complaint, but, you know, the way in which the person at fault is directed to make things better, that could be public. But if it's found to have not been upheld, found to be politically motivated, but, you know, and just to be dismissed, then it should remain confidential, because that's very damaging to people, and it also completely removes any faith that people have in a complaint system, because then people can use a complaint system as a weapon against each other, particularly in the political sphere and in other organisations as well, where you get kind of lots of sort of politics behind closed doors as well.
The other issue at the moment, which I was amazed to see, that one of the last things that this administration is doing, assuming it doesn't get back in May, is the massive hikes to allotment rents. Now, what do the Greens make of that, and what are you going to do if you take over in May?
Well, we stood side by side with allotment holders and supported them through that process. Martin Fodor, who's our chair of scrutiny for community scrutiny, made sure that we got the allotments on the scrutiny for communities. So we got to look at it, ask some questions, look at it in a bit more detail, got them to wheel back on some of those things. They've still pushed through the hikes. And it, like with a lot of the different issues that have kind of suddenly been pushed through in this last year, it's something that they were so underfunding their own allotment service, but they only did something about it in the last year of their administration. Why didn't they do it years ago? Why have they waited until the last couple of, like, the dying days of this administration to push it through? The same with a whole range of other things I'm sure you're probably going to ask me about in a minute as well, but there's a lot of things that have suddenly started happening now that they've been trying to keep off, or they've just slipped through at the very last minute, and goodness only knows what there's going to be waiting for whoever is the new administration.
Can we say maybe that there's lots of little creatures creeping out from under the carpet that they've been sweeping under for the last few years?
Massive crocodiles under the carpet.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to Cabinet this week, where we had some discussion about this whole business of upping the allotment fees, and some pretty shocking figures as well. I think we can hear now, this is on Tuesday this week, discussion about allotments with the mayor. We can hear a bit of him as well here.
Tessa Price.
This is a joint statement written together by 14 community projects and groups based on allotment sites across the city. Far from bringing new opportunities for collective food growing, these rent rises will be really damaging for our projects, and they risk closing some of us down. Partly, some of us may be financially not viable anymore. We simply can't cover our costs. Some of us will have a huge amount of extra admin work created by the discount scheme that won't be manageable for us. Collectively, our projects bring huge benefits to the people of Bristol, offering a sense of community, mental and physical health benefits, connection with our food and with land. I think we'd probably also save the council collectively huge amounts of money across other areas, things like the reduced need for send provision, the reduced need for mental health support and drug and alcohol support, probably dwarfing the increased income that's going to be created by these rent rises. Most of us, most of our projects don't take a penny in funding from the council. We really don't ask for much help from the council. All we're asking is that you don't wreck what we're doing by forcing through these ill-considered proposals. Please, please don't put through these rent rises. They are going to do so much harm to our projects.
Yeah, I mean, and please ask the... I will not go... If we want to shout out, I'll just stop and we'll use up the 15 minutes. I think the point I make is if we want to enter into a discussion and the gentleman earlier on is talking about informed, intelligent discussion, throwing words around like unhinged, whatever we just used, that these are not attached to anything, that's just not true. They are attached to a thought process. It may have produced a conclusion that you don't like, but they are attached to a process. And to suggest they're not, it does not help us move forward the argument. Again, as Ellie said, the point of fairness is one about a finite council budget in a city of increasing need, in the increasing cost of meeting those needs, means that we're in a precarious situation. And there's not an area of local government activity that's not been impacted by our financial situation we're in. So addressing that context as well, and at least acknowledging it, is incredibly important.
So that's the Mayor Marvin Rees there, ending that little clip from this week's Cabinet meeting here in Bristol discussing the future of allotments. And listening to it, Annie, I did get the idea that the council sort of allow these things to go on. Obviously, they have to sit and listen to what people have got to say, but they don't really seem to have any intention of really listening.
No, I was quite amused that Marvin complains that other people use sort of word salads when he's a champion of the word salad. Which is essentially what he was doing. It's very dismissive of residents' views, especially when they've taken the time to turn up to public forum. And this is always his response to them. It's really disheartening.
Well, this takes us back to governance, really. And Joe's got a couple of things to ask you, I think, about monitoring. Well, the monitoring officer particularly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the other issue there is that, as you were alluding to, there's been no complaints upheld for the last 6 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, it's come to light that the monitoring officer wasn't even following the law that's laid out in the Localism Act, mm-hmm. 2011, that says that you've got to have an independent person to assess complaints about councillors that come in, and that independent person has to be voted into position by full council, mm-hmm. by councillors. Which hadn't been happening since he'd been monetary officer, and that's been pointed out by various members of the public who are very persistently keep bringing this up, mm-hmm. at different committees, even at full council.
Observed, yeah.
Even at full council to the mayor, and the mayor turns around and says, "I can't comment on this. This is nothing to do with me. This is the executive has nothing to do with the complaints procedures. This is all down to." This particular committee called the Values and Ethics Committee. And there's this sort of strange situation where it's what everyone can see that the emperor's wearing no clothes, but no one in the councillors or anyone is prepared to say, you know, the top lawyer in the council who's supposed to be telling everyone else how the law works hasn't been following the law, you know. The state's how local government is supposed to work.
Well, the extraordinary thing about local government and politics generally is it's politics, and yet so much of it is classed as non-political appointment, even though it everything about it is political. Of course it is, and everything about all of the officers' role is political, even though they're technically classed as non-political appointments, which is where, for example, there's a new finance officer coming in that's being appointed by the current administration. Technically, it's a non-political appointment. The chief executive is a non-political appointment. The monitoring officer is a non-political appointment. And therefore, it's made, but it can be made by the administration. It is made by the administration. And so therefore...
You have political interests.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So it's, it's a contradiction.
And particularly in a mayoral system, that's all, that top-down thing is very concentrated. And another one I'd I'd point to would be the chief planner, who I think was appointed as in a political sense again, because there's someone who used to work with the chief executive of the Southwest Regional Development Agency, and was brought in to fulfil a sort of a politically mandated project of how we're going to manage the planning department and what's going on with planning.
Mm-hmm.
I get on to generally.
Mm. Okay, before we talk about planning a bit, I'd like to say something about SEND, because this special educational needs kids, I mean, for me, this is almost one of the major issues that we've had to deal with over the last 8 years or so, is the underfunding of the education of children with special education. I mean, these are the people that desperately need a really decent education. They need a specialist education, and it's almost as if, it's survival of the fittest. Sorry, you're not able-bodied enough to go to a proper school, therefore we're not going to be spending money on you. So there's something a little bit fascistic about the failure to fulfil this. And actually, of course, it's a statutory obligation of the council to do it. Now, money has been spent on things like the Colston Hall renovation. It's been spent on the Bristol Energy. There's been actually tens of millions spent on these projects, but they're not seen as a priority, it seems to me, Annie.
Yeah, well, so I have particular skin in this particular game. So I'm neurodiverse myself, and I also have a neurodivergent child who didn't have a school place for 3 years, and we had to home educate him. He's recently gone back into mainstream provision, but, you know, they haven't had the Senko for the first term. The amazing school, but no Senko, so he's not actually been getting the provision, because our kids are not, even when they're in mainstream school, aren't being given the provision that they require to really thrive. And it was a massive fight to get him diagnosed in the first place. That took, I think, 5 or 6 years to get him through that, you know, and it's a huge issue. It's an issue across the country, but it's particularly an issue in Bristol that we're not taking seriously enough, and it is a massive failing.
Well, there's some good news, apparently, announced by Marvin's, I'm not sure if she's deputy mayor, whatever she is, Asher Craig. So that was talked about also at Cabinet on Tuesday.
So agenda item 30, safety valve. And this, as I said earlier on, was introduced under APR 16. Asher, you're bringing this item.
Thank you. This report outlines our submission to be part of the Department for Education Safety Valve Programme. The Safety Valve Programme is intended to support local authorities to manage the historical deficits in their dedicated school grants. The terms of an agreement are not yet confirmed by the DfE, but we do anticipate it to be in line with the proposal we submitted in January, which will see funding of around £100 million. This includes a contribution over 5 years from central government, totalling around £54 million, with a contribution from Bristol City Council of around £43 million. This is a huge opportunity for Bristol to accelerate the reforms needed to help improve outcomes for children and young people with special educational needs and disabilities, whilst operating in a financial sustainable way.
So that's Asher Craig there speaking at Cabinet on Tuesday this week, Annie. And actually, it's almost like she's got her fingers crossed there. We hope to get this money from central government. Mm-hmm. This is a bit of an awful way for a big city like Bristol to be running the show, isn't it? To be hoping that they're going to get an extra grant from the council. And actually, what's happened over the decades is that central government has been cutting back and cutting back the amount of money that they're giving to local authorities to carry on. In fact, he's slowly starving us.
Mm-hmm. So, again, I mean, part of this is a governance issue. It's something that they knew was a problem, and they hid it until the very last minute and snuck it out at this point when we've only, I think it had like 5 minutes to spare on member question that could have been asked, but when they put it out on the Monday to come to Cabinet on the Tuesday. So the very last possible minute, not meeting even their minimum statutory regulations for this. But also, yeah, a whole basis of maybe they can get some stuff from central government. This is on the basis that we're all fairly sure that when there's a next general election, it's going to be a Labour government. Labour are fairly sure that they are going to take the administration. And Labour have also said, the government, and Labour have also said that they're not going to give local government and local authorities any more money than we're already getting. So therefore, the whole premise of this is highly questionable, because on one hand, the current Labour administration is tying the next administration into this for 6 years, because that's how long it runs for, which is longer than the term of the next administration, because that would be a four-year term. They're tying it into something on a wing and a promise of that a future central government may or may not give to us. It all feels very dirty, and the only people that are going to, the people that are really going to suffer is going to be the children. And it's, I think it's a really despicable thing to do at this stage of an administration.
Well, surely, I mean, at least they've put in an application for this money. I mean, at least they're trying to get some money from central government. It's actually not local authorities' fault. I mean, one of the Labour people will argue is saying, well, we're just having to cope with these cuts from central government. It's not really our fault.
I mean, just asking, and like you say, fingers behind your back, potentially, it's not really quite good enough. It's something that has been facing us for a very long time, and we've already sort of not given enough school provision places. Knowing that a baby boom was at its peak sort of 10 years ago, not making any provision for that, it's too little too late, and it's also just a bit of a gamble that doesn't seem to pay off, and it isn't going to actually mean anything good for children?
There's hope that some of this money comes through, but it would be not much nicer if the council just prioritised this a little bit more than they do some of the other pet projects. Listen, we had a budget in central government this week. I always look at those. Jeremy Hunt, whenever I see him, my heart sinks. I just think, oh yes, this is the guy that said there'd be no top-down reorganisation of the National Health Service, and then he did a top-down reorganisation of the National Health Service, which caused absolute chaos around 2012. And then he went into the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, and he got rid of all the rules for local commercial radio stations to be actually local, and so you've got big companies like Global taking up every single license and saying, well, that license that you won, well, I'll tell you what, we'll have it now. And so there isn't really such a thing anymore as commercial local radio. So he's now in charge of all of our money, which really made my heart sick. But anyway, but the week before, I think it was, that the budget was passed here. Now, this is a deal which I think the Greens objected to, but it was the Conservatives and Labour together that got it through. So this is a bit of a potentially worrying model where you've seen the two main opposition parties actually saying, you know, I'll tell you what, let's just get into bed with each other and make sure this budget goes through. So what did you make of that whole debacle?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very concerning that Labour would rather side and make a deal with the Conservatives than they would work with us, as you know, the people closest to them on the political spectrum. They'd rather not work with us, they'd rather work with the Conservatives, and we were cut out from actually a real collaborative approach to this budget that will be the budget that the future administration has to work with. And you know, they think it's going to be us as much as we think it's going to be us, and yet they didn't actually involve the Green Party in forming that budget in any way whatsoever. When it came to amendments, all that was left was that little pots where you're kind of moving, sort of stealing from Peter to feed Paul, and actually there's not a lot of those little pots left, so that we managed to identify one very small pot that was possibly being used for knife crime and one bit which we could move to use for a different bit of knife crime. But like, it's not a collaborative approach to the budget.
Well, look, I remember George Ferguson, when he took over, he was rather deft at moving stuff from one budget to another, even though he'd been told you could use it for this, he'd find some way of using it for something else in order to keep the services running. Whereas that doesn't really happen. And as part of that, the planning department at Bristol City Council has been absolutely denuded of staff. I mean, planners are experts in what they do if they're going to get it right. Also, they tend to be hoofed out or elbowed out if they don't come out with the right decisions in this present administration. So, Joe, I'd just like you to ask Annie a few questions about planning, because this week we've had the announcement. It's funny because we had our discussion about St Mary Le Port. Immediately there was an announcement, I think it was the following Monday, in the Bristol Post, that the government was thinking of bringing Bristol planning under central government control, and they've now actually done that, haven't they?
Yeah. They've done it for non-major applications, so it's not the really big stuff. But it's applications that I think are 10 dwellings or less, or under half a hectare. And they now go to the planning inspectorate rather than Bristol City Council's planning department, which, and I think from what I understand, that actually came as quite a shock to the chief planner and the senior council officers who didn't think they were actually that was actually going to happen, but they have now basically been put in special measures, and that is a consequence of basically a huge backlog in planning applications.
How many?
I don't know the number, but it's been building up.
I think it's about 1,700, if I remember rightly.
But they are one of the worst in the country. And that was a problem when the last head planner left, Gary Collins, last year, and they brought in a new chief planner, reformed the service. This was going to try and streamline the process and sort this out. But that hasn't happened. It's under resourced.
Yeah.
But it's also a question of losing.
Annie
staff
here is chair of one of the planning committees, and we've got to be quite careful because you're not allowed to talk about specific applications. But do you want to ask her a few things about how we've ended up with Joe with this situation?
Well, the thing that I've been writing about, talking about recently, is the political pressure on the planning department. Mm. And but that is something you've been aware of, or you were aware of quite a while ago.
Yeah.
But I guess this pressure is coming specifically from the mayor's office, and then what you could see with the St Mary Le Port application in the historic heart of Bristol that I wrote a long piece about was that you have planning officers who have basically said to developers, this application isn't acceptable. On this case, it was the height, mm-hmm. the scale, the massing of these office blocks. And then they are, those same officers are then recommending that there's application for approval. Yeah, I don't know if you've got anything to say about that.
I have many things to say about that. To start, so planning is a regulatory body, and so the Bristol City Council is the planning authority, and that's regulatory, again, supposed to be non-political. Mm. But then planning as a strategy and where we build things is a political strategic activity, mm. which comes directly under the mayor's own portfolio, under
in the cabinet.
That's his own thing. Exactly. So it's a bit of a contradiction, and those lines get a little bit blurred, especially when the council is the applicant for something. And so we saw it with Yew Tree Farm, we saw it with Gorham, for example, which is a bit of a arm's length kind of company, which is a planning, the building company,
the housing
company, yeah. Which is technically arm's length, a little bit like Bristol Waste, but it's also the council's company. And then those lines get a bit blurred because you end up with officers who are planning officers and then officers who are the applicant sat there side by side doing the same thing, and sometimes passing themselves off as just an officer. And because we have such of a change around in planning officers all the time, it's hard to keep up with whose face is who. Mm. And so sometimes I can be talking to somebody and it's only halfway through the conversation that I realise that actually they're not a planning officer. They are the applicant officer doing the site visit or representing, because they'll come, like at a planning committee, for example, council officers have a habit of sitting on the benches where the councillors are. I've started moving them off to the other end so it's a little bit clearer who is the applicant, who is the planning officer, because we often have additional planning officers there, like somebody from highways, somebody from legal, that sort of thing, to give additional advice should we need to during a committee. So that muddies the water quite a lot. And then because planning itself is a strategic political, it means, and it's strategic as well, it is the very clear aim of the administration to get certain things passed. And therefore, it does put planning officers in a tricky position, because the council's their employer at the end of the day.
Yeah,
and the thing is that when it, in law and in planning law and in our policies as well, planning policies, there is an element of open to interpretation. Most things aren't that black and white.
Well, there is some balance. It's weighing up the balance, isn't it? That's which they always say, and you get in every, for all these big applications. And this is how the planning system works, is that you've got to weigh up public benefits against harms that may be caused.
Exactly.
So, yeah. But we had this week, and you gave a statement at the meeting about the tallest building ever, that's ever going to be built, that's now going to be built in Bristol. It's a 28-storey student accommodation tower. So you've got this conversation about the harms versus benefits, but as you did in the St Mary LaPorte application, but as far as I can see, they've done exactly the same thing. What they did at St Mary LaPorte is totally remove what the specialist conservation officers were saying, take it out of the report, and if you look through the report for this one that went through this week, there's no mention of a conservation officer, the advice they've given. And this is the tallest building ever to be built in Bristol that stands right next to the oldest Grade 1 listed building in the city, St James's Priory, the 12th century church. So, and, you know, you've got legal precedent. In 2021, the Lewisham Council in London were told by a High Court judge that their planning permission had to be quashed for exactly this reason. They hadn't shown the advice of the council's own conservation officers. So, you know, as far as I can see, that they're not acting lawfully. But the thing with the planning system is that can only be challenged by someone doing a judicial review in the High Court, like they did with Lewisham Council, and that requires tens of thousands of pounds. So that's another aspect of it that you can, you know, which allows them to tread this line, and get this stuff through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it disadvantages the everyday resident, doesn't it?
Yes.
I remember on Wednesday when the high building came, officers advised that yes, there was massive harm to the conservation areas around it, to the heritage assets, to the local community, to the fact it kind of breached the council's own policies on student density as well, and transient population density. Despite all those things, on balance,
it outweighed. They can say that for anything.
You can choose it on balance. Yeah, as long as you give everything due regard, then and consideration, you can.
But they are supposed to follow a process of giving the councillors who are voting all the information they need, the information from all the consultees within the transport, the design officers, and they're filtering that.
Did you clock the advice that was given to councillors at the very beginning part of the meeting about the dangers of actually going and getting officer recommendation? Yeah. That was very concerning.
So is that normal for them to warn you? How dare you? Make sure you don't go against what the officers are recommending.
That's what it came across like.
I mean, that's what it was. That's why, it wasn't particularly subtle.
No.
That was, if you go against this planning recommendation, then, I mean, it's
unusual. Finish the sentence, though. What's the consequence?
So, well,
What are they suggesting the Swansea Council would be?
That the council would have to be liable for all of the costs on appeal.
On appeal, yeah.
And would lose on appeal. Yeah, which has always been the veiled threat that gets sometimes more explicitly made and sometimes a little bit more covertly made at various points when it seemed like we were going to overturn an officer recommendation. It's certainly a repeat conversation I have with the head of planning off of committee about trying to make sure that I make a committee follow the officer recommendation, which is not my job. But to have it made quite so explicitly is... unusual.
But the other thing that one of the things that troubles me about the planning committees is the way that the councillors are so reliant on the officers' direction and advice and opinion, and it seems to me that very few of those councillors, even the ones that have sat on those planning committees for years, have actually read the local plan and the national planning policy framework, which are the two documents that all planning applications are assessed against. And you're always getting these very basic questions going to the case officer. What is the training that the councillors on the committees get?
Well, I mean, on the whole, they're not lawyers or planning professionals. There are a couple, actually, who do have planning, professional planning experience and law degrees as well. So there are a couple of counsellors who do have that understanding.
Yeah.
But in terms of the training generally, it's more about understanding what material consideration is and what some of the elements of it are. There's certainly the deep dive into our policies is something that councillors are left to do a little bit more themselves. On my committees, I'm always very keen for it to not just be a rubber stamping exercise. I think it's really important that as a regulatory body, a planning committee follows, serves the same kind of process as a scrutiny committee in many ways, of scrutinising, is this really do the councillors actually agree with the officer recommendation and scrutinising a little bit more?
Because that's what their own critical faculties and their own judgment.
Yeah. My planning committee has rejected or got overturned officer recommendation quite a few times, which has caused a lot of questions. But I think the wrong questions asked. It's not why are we rejecting the officer recommendation? What can be done to make us follow the officer recommendation? I think the question is, why is the officer recommendation so wildly different so often to the members who have taken into account their residents, the residents of Bristol's views, because that's who we're there to serve and that's who we're there to represent. And so is the planning authority. And what the planning authority should be saying is, okay, so the councillors are listening to their residents and not agreeing with our recommendations. Why are we so out of step with what our residents want and what our residents need and what they're asking for? Because the overwhelming reason for voting against officer recommendation is because it's just not good enough. You know, that balance of it's not housing at any cost.
That's the thing with this week. You know, you could just say 28 stories is too high. You know, Historic England was saying it needs to take 8 stories off, and then it might be reasonable. Still not going to be great, but it's then reasonable. But there seems to be no appetite even to push the developers to do that. You know?
No. Well, I mean, there was a desire from the mayor's office for tall buildings. They like that. They'd like quite as like us to sort of be a bit more like Manchester in that regard. But I think explicitly what was being included in the application in those 28 stories and the lower block as well is something that we don't need or shouldn't be advocating for in Bristol.
What do you make of the irony, Annie, that it now looks as if there may not be the money, the finance available for this big development in the city centre to go ahead? So there's a massive battle over whether they can actually get the planning application through at St Mary Le Port, and then suddenly they say, well, no, it doesn't look like the money stacks up anymore. Maybe the economy's changed, we're in recession, and so doesn't it feel sometimes like the whole thing's a bit of a pointless exercise?
Welcome to politics sometimes. I mean, the amount of planning applications that have been approved that are just sat there not being built, so plots of empty land, you know, that is one of the real problems we've got about the housing crisis, that developers just sit on builds. They make applications, they don't necessarily build it, or they build it and they don't necessarily rent it out immediately. They certainly don't sell it or put it all onto the market at the same time. They sit on this stuff to inflate the market even more.
Right here in St. Paul's, we've got a massive piece of land that was, I think it was one of the big housing associations bought bit by bit, and it's just been best part of a decade. It's just been sitting there.
Is that the bit behind Circa Media?
Yeah, birds landing on it, sort of looking around. Well, nothing much going here, taking off again. Every now and again, there seems to be some kind of like circus come in and set up shop and then go. But this, of course, is prime house building land right near the city centre, isn't it?
It's like, a green policy, isn't Tony Dyer was talking about a couple of months ago. About this, a green...
Oh, about empty homes. And two things. One, I was going to say, if you mean the big piece of land just behind Circa Media or by the garage there is outline planning that came through DCB maybe 6 months ago, I think. So that there is something, but just outlines. It will take a while longer for it to go. But yeah, exactly. It's like a big empty plot of land, empty homes. That was a motion that we brought in... When was it? December, I think, lose track of time, to look explicitly at all of the empty properties that we've got, see what can be brought back into use. And because if you look at how many empty properties that we've got, that would actually make a sizable dent in our homelessness list, the amount of people we've got that don't have accommodation. There are obviously empty blocks that are offices and blocks that were residential that are just empty. There's one by the Beacon, for example, called Amelia Court. That's been boarded up for years and years. That could be brought back into use. There's loads of units across the city.
Well, I think you should be liaising with my other hat, which is Bristol Housing Action, the local squatting group. There's quite a lot of people who would be very happy to use some of those buildings as somewhere to stay. But look, you're going to have to get cracking any second now. So let's quickly have a listen to another clip from Tuesday, which is about Yew Tree Farm. Just a little bit of context. This is a council-owned farm where there's been all sorts of attempts to grub up, basically to use the land for other things. Maybe you could tell us what's going on there when we hear this clip from Tuesday, Annie.
Dan, you have a minute.
It's great that this council has applied for money from the West of England Green Recovery Fund, but what's the point of saying you'll proactively form relationships with stakeholders and communities across the city? Why would anybody engage with this council? I mean, you have forums and consultations to communicate with the public, but you just ignore them when they don't go along with your plans. This council has a real problem with only talking to people who will agree with what you want the council to do and talking about things that make you look good. You had a farmer who cared for a site of nature conservation interest, but it appears you don't like to hear about protected species. Instead, you've put someone in charge who has a clear desire to develop on that land. We can't even expect the Cabinet Member for Ecology to speak out about what is happening at Yew Tree Farm because the company they work for has Redrow for a client who have expressed an interest in building on that land. Why would anyone talk to you when you only talk to people when it's convenient for you?
Yeah, that's a pretty damning, it wasn't really a question, statement. But what's happening with Yew Tree Farm? Because this is quite, obviously, the council was trying to make sure that the bits and pieces of land, which are farming land, producing food, that sort of thing, that they do control, are being kept productive. But apparently that's not happening at Yew Tree.
No, so at Yew Tree, there's three different parts of the farm that are owned by different organisations or different people. So there's a part of the farm that is owned by the council, and that's the bit that the cemetery is being expanded into, which is the one that came to the planning committee back in November. That's an SNCI, so a special site of nature interest, conservation interest, which has got dormice and all sorts of protected species on it. And then there's a different part of it, also part of an SNCI, I believe, that Redrow are trying to expand into and build homes onto. And then there's a different bit again, which I'm not even sure what's going on that bit, but that had a hedgerow chopped down at several points. I think there was an application that was put in to chop down the hedgerow. The planning department didn't respond to it in time, and so therefore they got a permission by default. So then this bit of the hedgerow was chopped out, and there's ancient trees there, over sort of 200-year-old trees, and part of the hedgerow was chopped out but in the wrong place according to their application, but bigger than it needed to be, and they put concrete in, all sorts of things. It's And also dormice breeding season is March, and I know they were back there today doing some things as well. So there's a, and Avon Wildlife Trust objected in the strongest terms to the cemetery expansion into that part of Yew Tree Farm, and that was completely dismissed at planning, and they were dismissed as not knowing what they're talking about. And Avon Wildlife Trust, I believe, have issued a cease and desist on the council to make them, try to get them to stop doing action and to provide enforcement there, so that nobody is doing any work on that land, and that's not what happened.
What about this conflict of interest? This is what bothers me so much about council councillors, council officers that are also moonlighting for a company that's got an interest in a particular site.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very, very clear example of conflict of interest, because you've got, as it was Dan Aykroyd who was giving that statement in the council on the clip we just heard, talking about the Labour cabinet lead for ecology. So this whole situation at Yew Tree Farm is absolutely about ecology and what council ecology officers are doing, and. So this is Councillor Marley Bennett, who also works for the planning and development consultancy Turley, who have this housing developer Redrow as one of their clients. So the question is, is it feasible for him to speak out, you know, about what's happening to this ancient hedgerow that goes round this plot of land where one of the clients for the company that he works for wanted to build houses?
You know what I'm thinking about? We need to go back to the monitoring officer again. We were talking about this earlier on. There needs to be an eye kept on this sort of thing, surely, to make sure that you haven't got people on both sides of the chessboard sitting in the same committee and making the same decisions.
So obviously all councillors are required to declare their interests. Some of those I think you can keep confidential if it's particularly sensitive, so people don't necessarily know about them. But then there's also a quantity of, when it comes to predetermination and that sort of thing, the bar is actually quite low, high, which would, I don't know which right way around, but like in terms of, if you can sit there and say, I've come to this with an open mind, or I can confidently say I'm not predetermined on this issue, then that's good enough.
I mean, surely the best thing to do, say, look, I mean, you've got your own planning committee there. If you want to have an extension to your house out the back garden, surely what you do is, during that committee, you hand over the chair to somebody else and walk out the door.
It would. Well, I mean, if my landlord wanted to build an extension on the house I rent, then yes, I would still recuse myself. But yes, not everybody. Well, I mean, when the councillor has any kind of planning application, that has to come to committee as a kind of, we don't do that under delegated in order to make the full of transparency of that sort of thing. But yeah, in terms of employment, there's a lot of people actually who do work for organisations that then, like, I believe somebody worked for the applicant on the zoo, and then sat on that committee.
Oh God!
For example,
this is another
things
this
like
is
that. Like, people do it, but
we kind of forget some of the big changes that there've been under Marvin Rees, and that is getting rid of Bristol Zoo. Do you want to just remind us of the title of your article, Joe, where you do quite a deep look into some of the conflicts of interest and the friends of friends who've been recruited into the City Council to help with getting planning applications through?
If you look on my Substack, so I wrote a very long piece about...
Hang on, be honest. It's a book.
It's a book, yeah. Don't put people off, Tony.
But there is a short version.
But it's looking through this particular development, Samaria Laporte, that I was talking about last time I was on, but also trying to give a bigger overview of the situation of planning and development in Bristol, and it applies to other cities. But it's a conflict of interest, a revolving door between the public and the private sector. In Bristol, it's about the pressure from the mayor's office on the planning department, And we're seeing, I think, consequences of this in the fact the planning department is now under special measures. That's part of it. There are other factors, but it's part of it. But it's still going on. You know, we saw this week with the tallest building that's ever going to be built, ever to have been built in Bristol, which went through this week. I think that they're still doing the same stuff that I was writing about in there. You know, they're still pushing their specialist officers, keeping them out of the reports, not giving councillors the full information, especially now with a couple of months left of this mayoral system, you know, trying to get these big applications through while they can.
Are they getting them through your committee?
No. You can read into that what you will as to
okay.
how well, sidelined that is.
Also, we've got the mayor has announced that he's applying for this job when he finishes at UN Habitat, which is looking after the urban environment right across the world for the United Nations. Do you think he's got a good chance of getting that job? And how do you think he'd get on if he does?
I mean, he talks a good talk, but he doesn't walk it very well. It would be, I think, very disappointing for the climate should he actually, and the habitat generally, should he get that job. But I'm not on his interview panel, so I couldn't possibly tell you if you'll get it.
Oh, I wish you were. But anyway, we can wish away, can't we? Also, we've got this clean air zone. This has caused quite a lot of trouble, particularly a lot of people saying, well, it's actually not making the air any cleaner because people go around the zone, drive further, produce more pollution, particularly the sort of non-green side of this, because people are having to sell cars, perfectly good cars that work very well, but and buy new ones. So it's almost like a kind of help to buy scheme for the car industry as well. So what do you approve of the clean air zone? Do you think it's really about clean air, and is it going to stay?
I mean, we wouldn't have implemented this scheme in this way is the starting point of it. We wouldn't have done this because it's all been a bit of a hot mess. And it's sort of been almost set up to fail in quite a lot of ways. But then that goes for quite a lot of our walking and as our active travel infrastructure historically. It has walking and cycling in conflict with each other rather than complementary methods of travel.
Yeah. Well, the other major thing is we've been cutting buses, haven't we?
Mm.
Right the way through COVID and since COVID, loads of buses cut. Something like, I think, a total of 30% of all the bus journeys in Bristol. So the idea is if you're not going to, you want to get people to use the bus has got to be there.
Yeah, but I mean, replacement cars is the one kind of carrot. We want kind of more buses as part of the solution, but also making it safer to walk and travel and cycle around and those ways of transport. But also then making it so that people who do need to drive, people who are doing trades vehicle, people with mobility issues, who blue badge holders, for example, they do need to drive. And we want to make it so that they can. They do need to get to the hospital. Mm. They do need. And there's lots of things that we could do to make it more accessible to get to the hospital, for example. But none of that is happening. And actually, everybody's being disadvantaged and disenfranchised, except for the people who can afford to drive in.
Is it just a way of making money? Is that what it's really about? Or is it really about clean air? What do you think? I mean, I've been looking over the city. Obviously, I've lived in the city many years, and I've seen a lot of restrictions of roads, making them narrower, mm-hmm. cutting roads off. This has actually done, I think, more to reduce traffic in the centre than the zone has.
Well, I mean, they were made to do it. That's the thing, is that they didn't particularly want to do it. They were forced to do it, and they did it at the very, very last minute in the worst possible way. So what the actual aims of it are, slightly by the by in terms of the way in which they've implemented it.
Hmm. Is it going to expand, do you think, under the Greens?
I don't know. I mean, we're definitely going to look at parking zones, central parking zones, resident parking zones, how they work, how they operate, because they had massive price hikes recently as well, making sure it's equitable, making sure it covers all the areas that people want it to as well. There's a lot of things that need to be looked at and reconsidered and reevaluated as to, does this work? Has this actually been set up to cause conflict or to exacerbate an issue rather than solve it? that is a massive piece of work that we'll have to do.
Okay, and are we going to see our first Green MP in Bristol, do you think, when come the general election?
Let's hope. The sign's looking good.
You're in Central Ward here, mm-hmm. so there's this new Central
constituency. I mean, I'm miffed that they've called it after mine, but...
okay. What's your guess?
I think she's got a very good chance, yeah.
But who is standing?
It's Carla Denyer.
Oh, right, okay.
Who is co-leader of the Green Party nationally as well, okay. and current councillor for Clifton Down.
Well, thanks very much for coming in and chatting with us. I think you better scoot off to your Palestine thing mm-hmm. in Castle Park. Annie Stafford Townsend, Green Councillor for Central Ward here in Bristol, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so lucky. He's the only one I'll ever need. You were blessed of tonight. He puts his life on the line. Every time he's implied. A mannequin face. That our love will last beyond time and space. We are Spacer. A star chaser. A Spacer.
welcome to the revolution. The revolution will not be televised, but it will be here on Not the BCFM Politics Show. So that's high res. Welcome to the revolution. And if the algorithms were working really nicely, so you could dial that up on YouTube and you'll find lots and lots of other brilliant, really up-to-date, radical stuff that you won't hear on the BBC and you won't hear it anywhere else apart from on little alternative podcasts like this, because they hate it. They hate those sorts of brilliant songs like those guys have been producing in the States there. Before that, we had a little bit of disco. I hope you were doing a disco dancing at home to that. It was called Spacer by Sheila B. Devotion. I'm willing to bet that was sometime during the 1970s. And before that, I'm not quite sure. I think it might be even from Handel's Messiah or something. Anyway, welcome to back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, who we didn't hear from very much in part one, and me, Tony Gosling. Also, Joe Banks is still with us, and we're now joined also by Judith Brown. Hi, Judith. Nice to see you.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for inviting me.
And you were back from the Middle East recently. And
yes,
you had
I
a bit of an illness, which is a shame, because you couldn't do quite as much as you wanted to
do. No, indeed. But anyway, it was sunny.
Good. Yes, it's hot and sunny, man. Hot and sunny. Where are you, a lizard man? Anyway, so what are your thoughts about the recent developments? I mean, maybe you could just start by telling us something about your connection to Yemen, because very few people really seem to understand this country. And it is a relatively recently created country. If you look at it historically, it's kind of part of Saudi Arabia, part of the Arabian Peninsula.
Yeah, you've got it completely wrong, Tony.
Good.
Yemen is as old as China. It's been within the same boundaries with the same people and more or less the same languages for it's as old as China.
So
and
I'm
it's
just the, looking
they're the,
at the map.
They're the two oldest countries in the world, and it's a country that wasn't carved up but by the British. They did try to take the south, but it's back now, but they didn't rename it, they didn't give it a different name, and Oman too was its own country. But nearly all of the other countries in the Middle East and Arabia were created, including Saudi Arabia, of course, which was created by the British in 1934, I think.
This is the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was secret. Am I right, Martin, the Russians revealed that after the revolution, they'd seen it or something?
I think so, yes. Yeah. It was a secret agreement, but the Bolsheviks said, well, because they got access to because the Russians were involved in it as well. Yeah. So they got access and they published it.
Actually, Saudi Arabia wasn't created by the Sykes-Picot arrangements. Yeah. It was created, British...
So Sykes-Picot was after World War One.
Yes, it was, and it involved the French and the British, and it involved the Levant, you know, the where Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and Palestine is now mostly. But the British created Saudi Arabia, and they did it by there was a very small sect called the Wahhabis who were very extremist, and they sort of like got them to join with a family called the Sauds, and then they sort of created this sort of like extremist state, and which initially was quite successful militarily. It took part of Yemen, which is now the south west corner of Saudi Arabia. But Yemen is a very ancient land, and I think that, of course, I think that it, for many years it was for many centuries really, it was the richest country in the world.
Wow.
And because it controlled trade, because it's in the middle there between Africa, Asia, and Europe.
As they are now doing again.
Yeah, yeah. Indeed they are. And it controlled trade, and it particularly controlled the incense trade, and it also controlled the coffee trade through its port, Mocha. So for many years it was a very wealthy country, and I think what has been quite interesting is that it built these like amazing buildings, and then because Yemen became poor, people didn't knock the buildings down, but they stayed living in these ancient buildings. So you've got things like the old city in Sana'a, 3,000 years old, which is still being lived
in. Okay, well, this is a big question here, and I'm not sure if you're going to be able to answer it, but I mean, we've obviously got quite a lot of these UNESCO World Heritage sites in Yemen, because it's such a brilliant hotbed of history, and yet it's been being pounded by the British and the Saudis for the last decade or so. So is anything left?
Well, I think, yes, I think that there's parts of the old city, I think they altogether they dropped three major bombs on it, and that demolished some houses and also damaged quite a lot more. But and there are certain other sort of like important sites that have been damaged. But of course, the most important site in Yemen, really, which was one of the top UNESCO sites, was the island of Socotra, which the Yemenis had been amazing custodians of. It was completely unique, and it was completely uncivilized. We actually, they built a runway there in 1999, and we were one of the first people who went there as tourists, David and I, and they didn't have roads, and they didn't have an airport, but they had a runway, and when we flew in, we were actually met by the Minister of Tourism, which is quite incredible. But now I think,
did you have to show your passport?
No, because we were flying from Yemen to Yemen.
Oh, all right, fair enough. It's a bit like London City Airport, I was thinking, because they're not showing their passports, a lot of the planes landing in London City Airport either. But look, I mean, there's also, of course, the horrific death toll in Yemen. This is Al Jazeera reporting. Nearly 400,000 deaths by the end of, what's that, 2022? Yeah.
Yes.
By the end of 2021. This is quite an old report.
Yeah.
From memory, I think it was up over nearly 500,000 people in Yemen had been killed at that point. I mean, that's horrific.
I think not only sort of like killed, but I think that a lot of deaths have been caused by starvation, because there was a very long embargo in which the British government
was a part, indeed.
And when cholera happened, the Saudis went in and bombed the water supply, the sewage supply, and the cholera hospitals. They bombed a brand new hospital built by MSF in which was dedicated to cholera. As soon as cholera outbreak started, so I mean, there have been horrific things going on there, and I think that they were hoping that they were going to have peace. The Oman negotiated peace deals with all of the factions in Yemen, which is now quite divided, with lots of warlords controlling their little part of Yemen, and the accords were going on quite well. Saudi Arabia agreed to pay all of the civil servants in Yemen who haven't been paid since about 2017, when the central bank was closed by Hadi, and then the Americans decided that they'd send an envoy along to help along the peace talks, and of course since then they've collapsed.
Right, well, those Yemeni people must be pretty angry against the West. In a way, this war has been a recruiting sergeant because they are really the only country which is putting in major support for the Palestinian cause in Gaza, aren't they?
They are. Although, having said that, although I think that the Houthi regime now is popular throughout the Arab world and was popular many years ago in Yemen, but it has lost its popularity because it's as corrupt as everyone else. So, I think that a lot of Yemenis, they accept that the Houthis control, not half of Yemen, but the part of Yemen that's got most of the population in it. I mean, it's an acceptance. But of course, the Houthis are related to the old monarchy, which people had a revolution to get rid of. So therefore, but they're descendants of the old king or whatever he called himself of Yemen, that was deposed in the 1960s. So the Houthis have a sort of like a mixed reputation in Yemen. At the moment, I think people are disappointed because last year they were hoping for peace accords, which meant that they would get employment back and things going back to normal in Yemen. But in fact, now they've got bombs coming again. But in the rest of the Arab world, I mean, people sort of keep telling me this is amazing, because they know that I've got connections with Yemen, and they keep sending me sort of like notes saying this is fantastic. They've been talking about it on television in Tunisia or whatever, and everybody thinks the Houthis are amazing.
I think we can say on this show we do too.
Although,
of course, we don't want to see anyone killed.
No.
You know, this is sending a very clear signal, Martin, isn't it, to the British, the Americans, the Israelis, that if you want to keep trading through the Red Sea, through the Suez Canal, you're going to have to stop killing Palestinians, stop killing Gazans.
Well, when you say people haven't been killed, they have been killed, people killed by the Americans and the British, and, you know, they've killed Yemeni soldiers. And there's some sailors that died this week on a ship, an American registered ship, which the Houthis, Ansar Allah, as I prefer to call them, attacked. Because, of course, the Houthis is what their opponents call them. And of course, it's possibly legit. But I think it's, you know, the use of language helps people to sort of frame things, you know.
Well, Yemenis will do.
But anyway, the point is that what they've been doing is very powerful, because it's commercially, I mean, the Israeli economy is in free fall, partly as a result of this. And they weren't doing full-on attacks. They've kept the escalation ladder very carefully. They weren't attacking British and American ships either. They're just retaliating when the British and Americans attack them. And other ships are being allowed through. Although there was some report this week that these fibre optic cables have been cut. But the Yemenis said that they didn't do that.
I don't think that they'd be able to do it.
Well, exactly. It's quite difficult to do it. In any case, that's just a general attack on the whole of humanity.
Up a story on Middle East Eye, the picture of a rather low in the water, well, it's sinking, ship, sunk by a Houthi missile attack. Did it sever the Red Sea internet cables? Damage to fibre optic cables in the Red Sea has laid bare how vulnerable global internet traffic is to disruption, the lack of alternative routes through the Middle East. So is this what do you think? Is it,
well, I think there's an awful lot of psychological warfare going on. They're trying to justify what they're doing. They're trying to find a posse to go and fight in Yemen, and of course the way it's been pushed in our media is we've got to do this because it's keeping global trade going. They're just trying to destroy the world economy. That is not, as I see it, what they've been doing. They've been very, very cautious about escalating. And I don't think they would do something. I mean, they've said we didn't do it, because that's just a random attack on random stuff, which is not what we're about.
Yeah, see, and also, we were discussing last week, weren't we, how easy it is to put a signature of some other country on an internet attack of some sort. And, of course, if you cut a cable, that could be all sorts of different people.
Well, that's right, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, as we all know, was blown up by Putin.
This sends a very clear message to all of the IT-obsessed security structures around the world. Oh, look, the Yemenis are cutting your surveillance lines. And so there may well be a psychological element to that.
Yeah.
Anyway, how do you think it's going, this campaign of the Houthis to stop this traffic through the Red Sea and through the Suez?
Well, it's amazing, because in history, there's not been anyone who hasn't had a large navy and a lot of money that's been able to enforce an embargo. And Yemen is the first country that hasn't got a large navy and hasn't got much money that's actually been able to enforce the embargo.
Is this because of the missile technology that they're using?
It's because of the missile technology. And in fairness, it's because there's a very narrow gap at the Bab al-Mandab. And so therefore, that is Yemeni waters, the Bab al-Mandab. And traffic that goes up the Red Sea and then along the Suez Canal has to go through the Bab al-Mandab. So that's the reason, is because they've got a very narrow part to actually control. But the missiles are sophisticated, and Yemen is designing them themselves and
what we're probably going to hear all over our news programs here is that they're really just proxies for Iran.
Yemenis aren't proxies for anyone. They're a very independent people, funnily enough, before 2015, Iran, who supports everybody who's sort of like a protest or a dissident group, actually were supporting the southern Yemen, who wanted to succeed from north Yemen and become independent again. So it wasn't until after the start of the war that Iran became involved in Yemen, and it wasn't until Saleh, the ex-president, was killed by the Houthis. I'll say it's the Houthis because there's an interesting reason for that. They actually did call themselves the Houthis at one point. They named themselves after a martyr who was killed, but they've more recently taken on the name Ansar Allah. And I've forgotten my point
I will move things on a little bit, if you don't mind, because this time last week we had the most bizarre thing on the home front we're talking about here, with Rishi Sunak coming out around about 7 o'clock in the evening outside Downing Street, whilst one of those wonderful protesters, you can hear them screaming away in the background against the war, he's explaining, and here's a short excerpt from his talk, all about how dangerous it is to for the British people to elect somebody like George Galloway.
We are a country where we love our neighbours and we are building Britain together. But I fear that our great achievement in building the world's most successful multi-ethnic, multi-faith democracy is being deliberately undermined. There are forces here at home trying to tear us apart. Since October the 7th, there have been those trying to take advantage of the very human angst that we all feel about the terrible suffering that war brings to the innocent, to women and children, to advance a divisive, hateful ideological agenda. On too many occasions recently, our streets have been hijacked by small groups who are hostile to our values and have no respect for our democratic traditions. Membership of our society is contingent on some simple things: that you abide by the rule of law, and that change can only come through the peaceful democratic process. Threats of violence and intimidation are alien to our way of doing things. They must be resisted at all times. Nearly everyone in Britain supports these basic values, but there are small and vocal hostile groups who do not. Islamist extremists and the far right feed off and embolden each other. They are equally desperate to pretend that their violence is somehow justified, when actually these groups are two sides of the same extremist coin. Neither group accept that change in our country can only come through the peaceful democratic process. Both loathe the pluralist modern country we are. Both want to set Britain against Britain, to weaponize the evils of anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim hatred for their own ends. The faith of Islam, peacefully practiced by millions of our fellow citizens, is emphatically not the same thing as the extremist political ideology of Islamism, which aims to separate Muslims from the rest of society. Islamist extremists and far-right groups are spreading a poison. That poison is extremism. It aims to drain us of our confidence in ourselves as a people and in our shared future. They want us to doubt ourselves, to doubt each other, to doubt our country's history and achievements. They want us to accept a moral equivalence between Britain and some of the most despicable regimes in the world. They want us to believe that our country, and the West more generally, is solely responsible for the world's ills, and that we, along with our allies, are the problem. In short, they want to destroy our confidence and hope. We must not allow that to happen. When these groups claim that Britain is and has been on the wrong side of history, we should reject it and reject it again. No country is perfect. But I am enormously proud of the good that our country has done. Our place in history is defined by the sacrifices our people have made in the service of their own freedom and that of others. And when these groups tell our children that they cannot and will not succeed because of who they are, when they tell children that the system is rigged against them or that Britain is a racist country, this is not only a lie, but a cynical attempt to crush young dreams and turn impressionistic minds against their own society. I stand here as our country's first non-white prime minister, leading the most diverse government in our country's history.
If you listen to Rishi Sunak there, he's attempting to pretend to be even-handed. But what he's ultimately saying is that people who protest against the genocide in Gaza are extremists. Meanwhile, he's got people in his own party who say that Sadiq Khan, who's the democratically elected mayor of London, is controlled by Islamists. Whereas in actual fact, Al-Qaeda was created by our own intelligence services in the 1980s to fight the Russians. Everybody knows that, don't they?
Yeah.
Margaret Thatcher created Al-Qaeda.
And ISIS was created to fight the Syrians. Well,
exactly. So, I wrote a letter to the London Review of Books years ago about this. I said, we all know, do we not, that Al-Qaeda was created by our intelligence services. Robin Cook, who was a foreign secretary, said, Al-Qaeda just means the base.
Actually,
it's a database held in a man, Jordan, of all the people from all over the world, recruited, trained by our own intelligence services and special forces, and pushed into Afghanistan. Many of them from Tripoli in Libya.
Well, what happened
the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group.
What
many
happened to
Yemen.
Robin Cook?
Mm. Well, yes, I know. And in other words,
maybe next week we will have a little look at that.
Well, I know, but Rishi Sunak, of course, knows nothing about any of these things. He's never heard of Mary McCarthy, who was shot dead in Queen's University Belfast bar at 23 years old.
Could have been the president of Ireland. Ironic to me is he's talking about forces here in the UK trying to tear us apart, small groups. Well, I look at the cabinet and I think, well, actually, what you're doing by supporting genocide is creating a massive fissure in the UK.
Indeed. Well, I mean, I've been protesting on behalf of Palestine for decades now, and I'll have to say this. I've been on so many marches, and they always represent a diverse section of people, black people, white people, Asian people, Muslims, Jews, Christians.
People.
Yes, always Jews there, and always identifying themselves as Jews, saying, you know, with placards saying, not in my name. And then, of course, some in traditional Jewish clothes. So I think that the marches that have been on have not only been peaceful, but they've been multicultural events.
Yeah, response was quite interesting because that was actually a response to the election of George Galloway as an MP. Bizarre thing that, in fact, I thought it was rather nice to hear. And on several mainstream media channels last Friday evening, I heard various people, and on Saturday and over the weekend, saying, "Well, this was a very strange speech that he gave," and it was like that. That the journalists are hinting there's something a little bit unhinged about that whole affair, which was quite nice to see the London media getting that. But the response from George Galloway after Rishi Sunak's speech last Friday evening, which unfortunately we didn't cover last Friday, we couldn't. It was just, it was all happening whilst we were broadcasting. Here it is.
We at Sky have spent some time today on the streets of Rochdale, and there are people who say that they feel intimidated by people like you and the people that have supported you.
And they have pointed out
that you have concentrated your campaign on foreign affairs, and they worry that Rochdale will not be the winner.
That's my answer to you. I was just elected with a thumping majority by the electorate in Rochdale. That's all that matters to me.
So why are there people in the streets of Rochdale today worried?
Well, people voted yesterday, and they voted for me. Why is that difficult for you to grasp?
Why are there people on the streets worried?
There may be people who didn't vote for me who are worried, but the majority, the thumping majority, voted for me. I've got the mandate, and I'm going to the House of Commons with it.
And it's a mandate, you think, to do what? Because there are people that listen to what you say, what you say about whether or not Israel has a right to exist, what you say about what many Jewish people think are threatening slogans.
We had this
slogans.
Conversation last night. Why are you reheating it?
Because in the light of the Prime Minister's statement...
Don't keep
statement.
Telling me about the Prime Minister as if he was Moses.
Do you not respect the Prime Minister?
Do I respect the Prime Minister? I despise the Prime Minister. And guess what? Guess what? Millions and millions and millions of people in this country despise the Prime Minister. I don't respect the Prime Minister at all.
What are you planning to do next week when you arrive in Parliament?
Well, I'm meeting the Speaker on Monday morning, and then I'll be introduced and sworn in. I'll be escorted by the Right Honourable David Davis MP, former Deputy Leader of the Conservative Party. I don't know why he would do that if he thought I was the kind of man you're clearly implying that I am. David Davis is one of the great parliamentarians of today and this age. And I'll be taking my seat in the House of Commons and speaking for the people of Rochdale. That's what I was elected to do.
And what is your message also to Keir Starmer?
My message to Keir Starmer is that the skids are under you in scores of Labour seats up and down the country, because you've lost the trust, you've lost the confidence of millions of your traditional loyal voters.
Now, we have now had an election where two of the candidates have alleged intimidation. The Prime Minister referenced that intimidation in his address
on
the steps of...
to the Prime Minister as if that's supposed to impress me. The Prime Minister is a rather diminished and degraded politician. He made a party political statement. I don't care about Rishi Sunak's attitude. What I care about is that the returning officer, a man of unimpeachable integrity, I'm sure you'll agree, declared it a free and fair election, and me as the winner, and Rishi Sunak as one of the crushed two big parties in the state.
So why are two candidates?
Keep repeating the same questions to me because I have other people to talk to. So let's make this the last one, shall we?
We got a party to go with.
Allegations of intimidation. Allegations that your supporters intimidated other candidates.
What times you've said that? The returning officer declared it last night. You were there as a free and fair election, and me as the winner.
And the Electoral Commission today have said that they're going to look and talk to the parties.
You have to just suck it up. I won the election.
George Galloway, thank you very much indeed. That was George Galloway with his supporters now shouting bye-bye. Live on Sky News with his first reaction to the address by the Prime Minister.
So, yes, we've got a new voice in the House of Commons. Martin, what do you make of Mr. Galloway?
Well, I've known George Galloway for many years, on and off, and he's inimitable. I mean, the alliteration he got in there, diminished, diminutive, degraded. And that just came off the top
of
his
head.
It's
poetic, isn't it? Actually?
Well, it's because he can think on his feet.
Yeah, he's incredible.
Can you imagine Keir Starmer or Rishi Sunak or Joe Biden coming up with a something like that just on the spur of the moment? Yeah. They can't do it.
No, he is an amazing orator.
So how
wooden does Rishi Sunak sound in comparison?
Well, that's right.
Making that absurd speech. Trying to be the big man outside number 10.
Do you think that some of those speeches may be written by AI? I'm not.
Could well be.
I mean,
just bizarre. That's Sunak's response to a by-election victory. You know, part of the democratic process, and making this ridiculous speech about democracy, you know, being under threat. It's ridiculous.
What's democracy is under threat by is, I think, by the two major parties and the two-party system, as Galloway always says, two cheeks of the same backside, which, you know, another term is Team A and Team B. And it seems like Team A are rather worn out, so it's time for Team B in the general election this year. But Galloway is also very incisive about the Israel lobby here in Britain, and particularly about Labour Friends of Israel.
But both the Speaker and the Deputy Speaker last night, who presided over this shambles, were both members of the Labour Friends of Israel. I call them the Labour Fiends of Israel. It's just a misprint. I just dropped the R. The Labour Fiends of Israel. How does it happen, by chance, that both the Speaker and the Deputy Speaker
in charge of that chaos were both members of the Labour Friends of Israel. Why does Israel have so many friends in the Labour Party? Yeah. Why? They're not friends of Zimbabwe or friends of Turkmenistan. They're all friends of Israel. Why? What is it that they find so particularly attractive about an apartheid state that's on trial for genocide? Not one of them has resigned. Not one member of the Labour Friends of Israel has resigned over the last 130 days. I want you to know, Paul Daniels, she died.
Debbie McGee. Debbie McGee.
Debbie, ask Mrs. Paul Daniels. Thank you.
You're welcome.
What first attracted you to the multi-millionaire Paul Daniels? It was one of the most devastating questions ever asked on television. And I would like to ask these Labour fiends of Israel, what first attracted you to this state 2,500 miles away of 6 million people? And you're endlessly going there. They're donating large amounts of money into your election campaigns, into your political party. Keir Starmer has had hundreds of thousands of pounds from the fiends of Israel. And unless you know, you don't know. I know, and you know now, because I just told you. You're probably, many of you already knew, but the mass of the public don't know. They think that Keir Starmer is saying what he's saying because he believes it. But I know that that isn't true. Because I stood in a room listening to a speech by the same Keir Starmer in 2015, ancient history I know, 9 years ago. I was there, saw his lips move as he made a speech calling for Israel to be kicked out of the Football Association, FIFA, because they were a racist apartheid state. Imagine, in 9 years, he's gone from wanting to kick Israel out of football to being Israel's biggest supporter anywhere in the world. I wonder what happened on that road to Damascus. Thank you.
So, Martin, this is quite clearly massive in the United States and here too. The Labour and the Conservative Friends of Israel taking vast amounts of money from the Israeli state, which is actually most of it just coming from the United States, big grants to Israel, in order to help their election expenses. But this is obviously affecting the way they're voting on these issues.
Well, if you think about the Labour MPs in Bristol, Fangham Debonair, Darren Jones and Karen Smith are all Labour Friends of Israel. I understand that Kerry McCarthy is not. And you, as Sir George Galloway points out, why are they friends of Israel? Why aren't they friends of Palestine, for example? You'd expect lots of Labour MPs to be Palestine solidarity supporters. Why aren't they?
Well, you didn't mention Damien Egan, who is the MP for Kingswood, new Labour MP,
and
for
he's
Kingswood.
Also a Labour friend of Israel, and married to an ex-Israeli spook.
Yeah, Yossi Felderbaum is his husband, and as we said last week, I'll share it again this week. Some bright spark at the Electronic Intifada has dug up his CV and his work history. Quite clearly, he's worked for 6 years for this thing called Unit 8200, which is the Israeli equivalent of GCHQ. And there is a picture of him there next to the Clifton Suspension Bridge. So we have a penetration of the British political process by Israeli spies.
Well, that's clear. I mean, the Al Jazeera sting on Shine Moffat, was it?
Yeah.
The Mossad agent who was approaching the Labour MP, I can't remember her name, Joan somebody or other. She was actually left the Labour Party, resigned at one stage, because it was under the Corbyn regime, as it were, and now she's back in the good books and all the rest of it. You know, it's becoming very clear that one of the the electrified rail for Corbyn was this whole question of Israel-Palestine. Yeah. They didn't like anything that he was standing for, but that was the one that really got them going. Because, of course, Britain's role in the creation of the State of Israel is fundamental. And if Britain was to decide that it no longer, you know, and of course British public opinion is still quite hostile to mainstream Israeli opinion. There's a big gap there. And that's not represented in our political process at all, is it? And, you know, this is, we are also potentially the weakest link, I would suggest. Because I don't know anybody who's in favour of the RAF bombing Yemen from Akrotiri in Cyprus. And then maybe I'll ring moving the wrong circles. I mean, business is it of ours to bomb Yemen from Akrotiri?
Having done a documentary in the past with RAF pilots during the time of the first Gulf War, they were quite, off the record, quite adamant with me that they hated doing it. They really felt that this was something that they... and they were also blowing the whistle on some of the lies about the smart bombs, the smart technology, telling me that although they make out that these bombs can't miss, actually quite often things go wrong and the bombs just go haywire and go anywhere and maybe hit a market square instead of the target that they're supposed to be hitting. But at the ultimate, the political masters behind the Royal Air Force don't really give a fig for this. So, I mean, rather than focusing on Gaza this way, there's all sorts going on there. But since you're just back from the UAE, Judith, what about other Arab countries? Do some support Yemen? Do some not support? And of course, we've got the Gulf states, which are these little kind of tiny little places as well. So
I think the majority of the people in Yemeni countries support Gaza and are against what's happening now. And there are some countries that where politically the leaders are also supporting Palestine.
What about somebody like Saudi Arabia? Because I mean, they're supposed to be an Arab country.
Yeah.
But
Saudi Arabia is quite interesting. They have these things called the Abraham Accords. I think they use the name Abraham because in Islam they have Ibrahim and it's the same person. So they called it the Abraham Accords because it's a link between Jews and Muslims. UAE was the very first person to sign, followed by Bahrain. Then Sudan signed. You see, people are all being bribed to sign. You were talking about money to support politicians, but money also, for example, Sudan had its debt wiped off and was also taken off the terrorist list. Morocco signed, but in return for signing the accords, it was said that they could now control the area that they've been occupying for almost as long as Israel's been occupying Palestine, the Western Sahara. So that's now part of Morocco.
Diplomatic deals being cut behind the scenes.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So therefore, people are being bribed in order to sign the accords. Most people have heard that Egypt has said that they've told Egypt that they would wipe its debt off. It's already has diplomatic relations with Israel if it accepts refugees from Gaza, and people seem to think that they are actually preparing to take some Gazan refugees there, but that's speculation, but I suspect that it might happen. So so people are being sort of like bribed with sort of like large sums of money. I think UAE has colonialist ambitions of its own, and therefore it fits in very well with Israel. And then Bahrain is just the leaders are sort of like a very nasty bunch, and so they fit in and didn't need bribing, but all the time they're trying to find reasons to get sort of countries to sign. Some countries have definitely said that they won't. I mean, obviously you've got you've got Syria, but Saudi was just about to sign the Abraham Accords, and when in fact the Gaza war broke out. So
let's just make it clear:
signing.
This Abraham Ibrahim Accords is between Israel and Arab states.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. What about the Houthis? What are they actually saying about why they're doing what they're doing?
Well, they've made it quite plain that that the reason why they're doing it is until the Gazans get adequate food and nutrition.
And we keep hearing from our own politicians that this is not the reason, that, you know, this is nothing to do with Gaza, but this is not what the Houthis are saying.
No, it isn't. They're making it quite plain. And they've said that as soon as... that they've actually said medical aid... food and water, and as soon as the people in Gaza have sufficient, then they're going to allow ships to go through the Bab el-Mandab. They've made it absolutely clear. There's absolutely no doubt that is what they're saying.
Martin, isn't it absolutely obvious that if you're a shipping company, you want to avoid the Red Sea, really? It doesn't matter, actually, even if you think you're safe. It's not a great place to be if you've got a container ship.
Well, I think this is the idiocy of the so-called Operation Prosperity Guardian, which the British and the Americans signed up for, and Australia, New Zealand, Bahrain, and a few others hanging around in the background, Canada. I mean, no, the only Arab state which said it was part of this coalition was Bahrain, as you say, and that's because the Al Khalifa family are Sunni thugs, basically, put in power by the British in the 19th century, and they dominate the Shia majority in Bahrain. Yeah. So when there was during the Arab Spring, the people in Bahrain rose up against the Al Khalifa family. The Saudis actually sent their army into Bahrain to support the Al Khalifa family, and that's where the US Sixth Fleet is based. So nobody else, including the UAE or Saudi Arabia, supports Britain and the US in taking on the Saudis.
Let's just go back a second to Rishi Sunak's speech last Friday, because he was talking about how dare people say that Britain's been on the wrong side of history, because actually what you're saying there is that actually the Brits have caused much of this.
Well, there's a very good book by Caroline Elkins, who's a US academic, which has come out a couple of years ago. You can look it up on the computer if people are interested. It's about the British Empire, and it's basically about how bloodthirsty it was. As a Brit and a patriotic English person, I would say, I do not want to hide for a second from the things my country has done. Why not? We can take it. We know who we are. We know what we've done. And because of that history, we've got quite a radical tradition as well. We're opposed to this sort of stuff. We fought two world wars to stop it. The State of Israel was created by us and was through the Balfour Declaration and the recognition of the State of Israel in 1948. And therefore, we've got responsibility for it. And it's no saying we've got no responsibility for it. Of course, it's our responsibility. You answered it.
And of course, that was anti-Semitic in its way as well, because no countries in Europe nor America would take the refugees from the Holocaust, and so that then they were forced to place them into somebody else's country.
That's right. I mean, in actual fact, the Zionist lobby in the US. Can I just pick up on this?
Go on.
The Zionist lobby in the US. Most Jewish refugees in Europe at the end of the war wanted to go to the United States.
It's obvious
place for them to go, and because it was in a prosperous country, got an established Jewish community, and they were told by the Americans, because they were lobbied by the Zionist lobby, that they couldn't take them. Roosevelt was in favour of taking them. He said, okay, we can take that. Why not? They'll fit in. But no, they all had to go to Israel, because that's what the Israelis claim. The Jews can only go to Israel. It's the only safe place in the world for them, and so on and so forth.
Caroline Elkins, Martin, you were mentioning there, has obviously found her niche. She started off in 2006, this book, Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya.
Yes, it's a very good book. It's about what happened in Kenya.
And in fact, you were talking about Frank Kitson last week, weren't
you? Yes, he died in January.
And the death of Kitson. I mean, he's the author of the two books that I know of. One is called The Gangs and Counter Gangs. The other is Low Intensity Operations.
Low Intensity Operations.
So these are both ways to fight kind of guerrilla wars, but by infiltrating controlling the opposition to the imperial power, in this case Britain, And also extreme ruthlessness. So in a way, it's almost like what was going on with the IRA and Steak Knife, and we haven't really talked about that this week much, but this is a big today, particularly in the news, is the way that the British Army were actually controlling the nutting squad in the IRA. This is, in a way, straight out of...
Straight out of the kitchen playbook.
Yeah.
I mean, he's very influential, not just on British counterinsurgency operations, but also American, Israeli counterinsurgency. And when you say it's counterinsurgency, that's to sort of what he used to do in Kenya, and what the Seller Scouts used to do in Rhodesia, is they would dress up as Mau Mau and then go out and kill people, so that people got the idea that the Mau Mau went around killing loads of people. Then they created a massive prison camp system, which virtually 1.5 million people were put through these prison camps, out of which, as Caroline Elkins showed, at least 200,000 people died in those camps. So there were more people in prison in Kenya as political prisoners at that time than in the Soviet Union, and these were death camps. They killed a lot of people. And nobody was ever punished for any of it.
It's in contrast to the British in Yemen, because we interviewed a couple of years ago Kevin Cahill, who was a soldier in Yemen, and he said, well, basically, as soon as things started blowing up, they pulled out. There was hardly any casualties there were quite a few casualties on the first few weeks, but the British pulled out almost as soon as things started kicking off in Yemen. But in Kenya, they decided they were going to do everything they could to hang on to that. Why do you think that was?
Well, in Kenya, you had a very well-established, very wealthy, aristocratic, white farming elite. When I say they were farmers, they didn't do much farming, but they owned a lot of the land.
Yeah.
And therefore, they had a lot of pull in Britain itself.
Kenya is a very strategically placed as well, isn't it? Because, you know, it's all very well to control a few countries around the edge of Africa.
Yemen is even more strategically placed.
Yemen is the most strategically placed country in the world. And the reason why
they pulled out, is the Labour government that pulled out in 1967, is because Aden was originally important because it was a coaling station to go on the way to India, which was the real jewel in the crown of the British Empire. But once India had become independent, there was no point in Britain hanging on to Yemen.
Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? The other book that she's done more recently is called Legacy of Violence, A History of the British Empire. That's the one I was talking about.
It's a relatively recent book.
Up to those both on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
A book Rishi Sunak should read in his retirement.
Well, yes, but it's not going to go in. It's almost like...
Well, he comes from East Africa himself.
You can say stuff to these people and they could read it, but it's not actually going to go in because they're not interested. Their brain doesn't work like this. Almost you could wave something in front of Sunak's face, your hand in front of his face, and it would be totally blank. Anyway, let's get back to Yemen. We had a bit of a tangent there.
Yeah.
What about the global effect of all of this? Is this really having a big effect on global trade and policy?
It has having an effect, because what's happening is that they're saying that overall shipping, the movement of ships in the world is actually increased by 40%. So that you could say that adds a cost. But
when you say movement, you see, does that mean miles travelled or something?
Miles travelled, it's actually increased by 40%.
Isn't it an extra 3,000 miles or something?
To go right around the Cape, yeah. And I suppose a lot of shipping comes through the...
That's quite a lot of diesel.
But it's not just the cost. What's happening is that those ships are at sea for much longer. So it's actually meaning that there's not enough ships to sort of move goods that need to be moved as well, because it's tying up shipping by them.
Well, that's handy,
much longer
because we've
journeys.
Got a recession.
Indeed.
What about you were talking a bit about the weapons that the Yemenis are using. Are they really weapons that the Yemenis are manufacturing themselves?
Yeah, they're manufacturing themselves. They're cheap, and they're quite sophisticated, and they've designed them themselves. They're producing them themselves. They're completely sovereign in terms of their weapons.
Do you know how successful the British and American strikes have been in stopping, and have they? You know, they've been really surgical in trying to take out the places where these are being fired from or manufactured from.
Well, apparently not. They have been attacking sites around Yemen that they think are manufacturing weapons, but the Yemenis haven't said that they've attacked any major structures. But in terms of sort of like the firing pads for the missiles, they're all mobile, so therefore they fire them and move them. Mm. So therefore they're very difficult for them to track and bomb those particular sites.
Well, I mean, this is obviously one on the on the nose, maybe. Yeah. Yes, a punch in the face, really, for the West. But what about the effect on the South, the BRICS countries, the alternative? This is a growing
I think that what it's doing is giving more confidence to the South, because what you're seeing happening now is not only Yemen isn't afraid of America and UK. In fact, most people in the north of Yemen during the war thought that they were fighting, it was a proxy war with Saudi fighting on behalf of UK and USA. So therefore they've lost their fear of America. But not only the Yemen have lost their fear, but also a lot of other countries are, like you see the South Africa taking countries to the International Court of Justice. Not only have they taken Israel, but they're now planning to take UK and USA accessories.
I, as a patriotic Brit, say brilliant. Yes, let's get our government in the dock and send them to jail for genocide. So what about the fact-checking? Because you often come in and talk about fact-checking.
Yeah.
Gaza and Yemen are two big topics that I imagine the likes of Google, people sitting there with their algorithms are going to be trying to steer us down a rabbit hole somewhere.
Indeed. I think the fact checkers are doing much the same as the mainstream media. But I think what's quite interesting about the mainstream media, there is a story that came out this week. A story was published in the New York Times in the middle of December about the rapes the alleged rapes by Hamas on October the 7th. And apparently the staff of the New York Times felt that the story that hadn't been verified, and they checked the beds. This I think they're called grade 4 beds or something, and these beds in Israeli hospitals that are so that all people who've been attacked sexually go into these beds, and none of them had been occupied after the 7th of October. They also checked with the crisis center, the rape crisis center in Israel. There were no cases. They also went to this center which was giving holistic care to the survivors of the rave, where 200 people had been killed, and they said that no one had reported any sexual violence. And also in the Israeli newspapers, they're saying that for example, newspapers like the Times of Israel, quite conservative newspapers in Israel, are actually saying that there's no forensic evidence of rape. So taking this all together, I think the staff of the New York Times had been in dispute with the editors and wanted to withdraw the story, which the editors had refused to do. And last week they went to The Intercept with the evidence that this story was hadn't been verified, and yet the New York Times... I think this is more interesting than the story, because I haven't heard of any staff in a newspaper, and they must be doing it together, because otherwise they wouldn't have confidence in doing it, of actually going against a story on that favours Israel being published in a newspaper, and have actually whistleblown on the fact that the newspaper is publishing stories that aren't verified.
This is sort of mind-blowing in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because what you've got is the facts are not being checked by the New York Times, and so people don't trust what they're reading, and so therefore they've got to set up this whole network of fact checkers.
Yeah.
But the fact checkers don't check the facts which are wrong.
No, they check the facts that don't concur with the narrative that powers wish people to hear. And I've been checking AFP, which is the biggest fact check group in the world, to see how they've covered the conflict.
Is that Agence France-Presse or
yes,
something
it
to
is.
Do with them?
Yeah.
It's their own one.
Yeah, they're huge into fact checking. Right. They've got fact checking platforms in most countries in the world, several in some countries. They're huge. They're easily the biggest fact-check group. There's no other fact-check group that comes anywhere near the size of AFP. So I checked the first 3 months after from the 7th of October until the 6th of January, 6 months, their fact-checks. They had 140. in line with many fact checks, well over a third were trivia, like how many people attended a rally, what some celebrity said about Gaza, so sort of absolutely minor things. But then when you look at the ones that were actually about the Gaza war themselves, I think there were 84 fact checks out of 140 that were actually about the war itself. But if you looked at those, a lot of those were sort of like really fringe issues, and they were criticizing the Palestinian story, not the Israeli story. So, for example, they said things like, this bit of clip, which was meant to come from Gaza, we found that it came from Syria or an earlier war or something like that. This was an actor acting the part. So these were all sort of like fringe issues, and they didn't look at any really core issues. Like, for example, the allegations that have been disproved that were linked to the Israeli narrative, things like the beheaded babies, for example, things like the rapes, that they didn't look at those issues, and they haven't looked at any sort of issues that the Palestinians have raised. So they're only fact checking really on behalf of the Israeli lobby.
Okay, so who funds the fact checkers?
Now, the fact checkers are all funded by the extremely wealthy countries, especially in Europe and America, EU. They're funded by wealthy philanthropists, European and American philanthropists. They're funded by large corporations such as Google and Meta. So if you like, all of the fact checking industry, which probably amounts to sort of like billions rather than millions per year, is actually funded by the stinking rich and the powerful.
Martin, there's something a bit Orwellian about this, isn't there? Because you've got these people sitting in their high towers, the top floor of the media corporation, people like Mr. Murdoch, etc., and they're saying, hey, look, we're getting these surveys back saying people don't trust us anymore, so we're going to have to set up fact check. We're going to have to get these fact check people so that people will think that this being fact checked, and that will make them trust us more. But actually, this is really just a kind of sticky plaster over the problem. And I wonder what you make of it, because it's almost as if they're not interested in actually getting the facts right. They just want to have some sort of illusionary appearance of getting the facts right to affect the mindset of the person reading it, not the actual the balanced journalism and the facts themselves.
Well, it's not a sticking plaster. It's actually part of the disinformation campaign by the powerful. Mm. You know, fact-checking, as described by our colleague here, is exactly that. It's part of the wall of lies and disinformation. And, of course, most people are unaware of the existence of these organisations. They're only probably heard about by people who read quality newspapers and so on. People who read The Sun don't bother about fact-checking, you know. They know it's a load of rubbish when they're reading it.
And so when they have... the reader or the viewer has some doubts, we're told, oh, okay, you can scan this QR code and you can find out what the fact checkers say about this. I'm getting to the point where I start thinking, well, if something's been fact checked, then it's probably true.
I think if something's been fact checked, it's probably exactly what those in power want you to know.
Yeah, and they don't do proper fact checking, and of course journalists used to check their own facts. That's what you're supposed
that's
to
what
do.
We all used
that's
to
in
do.
The, yeah. That's in the job.
Well, some of us try to do it all the time. Yeah. So look, this particular New York Times story, I think it's interesting. In
yeah,
that
it is indeed.
What's happened is you've basically got some sort of Israeli. Israeli Defense Force press release, a bunch of text that's just been cut and pasted into the New York Times paper and website without being properly checked. And the same sort of thing has been going on, exactly same sort of thing, on the same day, whatever it was about, I think it was about 6 or 8 weeks ago, when the International Court of Justice announced their verdict on the Israeli genocide. Well, what they were saying is that we don't yet believe that this is a genocide, but the Israelis are on notice that they must make sure that they don't commit any genocide. We will be watching. And so this is an ongoing process. They're now monitoring it, the International Court of Justice, and there may well be a judgment that it is genocide under the Genocide Convention. Yeah. But this was a PR blow for them.
Yeah.
And so on the same day, the Israelis released this what I would call toxic press release about UNRWA, which is United Nations Relief and Work Agency, having Hamas fighters from the 7th of October working for them. Well, there was apparently 12 people who'd been involved in this is according to Israelis. And again, this wasn't fact-checked. This was just cut and pasted into the news of the world and into the minds of the people in the Western world. Other parts of the world, of course, did fact-check it.
Yeah.
But so I thought we'd have a little look now at that, because the effect of cutting, as so many countries did, first of all, it was the Five Eyes countries. So obviously Israel is already not supporting UNRWA, but you've also then got, because that's the sixth of the Five Eyes, you've got Britain, United States, Canada, Australia and New Zealand. They all stopped funding the UN aid agency in Gaza. And then we had roughly half of the NATO countries. Yeah. They also stopped funding. Yeah. So this is quite obviously nothing to do with whether there's some sort of terrorist in UNRWA. It's just doing what the Israelis wanted them to do.
Well, what I think is, if there were any UNRWA people in that attack, and I think the attack itself probably was illegal, it was illegal, but it was illegal in the sense that it was a crime, and therefore people should have been, the individual members should have been sought out and then given a prison sentence. So if they've got the names of 12 UNRWA people, I've heard 7, but you've heard 12, but if they've got the names of those people, they should take them to the Israeli court, and if they are able to conclude that they did kill and attack Israeli civilians, then they should serve a prison sentence.
The point is that these are allegations against these people.
Only allegations. They need to be proved in court. But to stop the funding to UNRWA at a time of a potential genocide is actually appalling. There's nothing else can be said about it.
Well, it's the fact is that they have done that. They've and they still haven't been funding UNRWA. Although David Cameron says we now have a plan to resume funding UNRWA, that doesn't mean to say he's going to start funding them again. Yeah. And this is really piling misery upon misery and genocide upon genocide by now continuing to starve these people, and of course they're dying at a rate of knots. So also looking at this whole situation with getting aid in, and even if UNRWA is working, I mean, it's also quite important to say that UNRWA has 12,000 employees, so what they're alleging is 12 of those may have been involved. There are other estimates of 24,000, because it has all these peripheral organisations helping UNRWA. So you're talking here about 1 in 2,000 people in this organisation potentially being involved, allegedly being involved, and you haven't investigated it, but you're going to cut the funding anyway, and of course that's going to mean people dying, possibly thousands of people dying because they're not getting aid anymore. But I thought it very important and useful to look at this chap Organi, and I can't remember his name because it's like organic food or whatever, but he's got the C missing off the end. And there was a report this week about this Egyptian guy, and we heard this a couple of weeks ago from Vanessa Bealey over in Damascus, and I've followed it up, and here's a report about the plight of Palestinians, which was reported, really good report actually, on Sky, on Sky TV, and what about it?
Rafah, on the border with Egypt. No one wants to be here, but there is a way out. It comes, though, at a vast cost. Sky News can reveal how one Egyptian company controls the only commercial crossing out of Gaza, and it's now charging Palestinians $5,000 to leave.
We were shocked with the prices, absolutely out of our league.
It's just too expensive. God willing, the price will go down.
Our investigation, based on the testimony of more than 70 Palestinians and analysis of documents and videos, shows it's increased its fees 14-fold since the start of the war, recently earning more than $1 million per day. Former industry insiders have called it criminal extortion. It leaves Palestinians with an impossible choice. Come up with a vast sum, or stay in Rafah and wait as Israel prepares its final ground assault. But over time, the number of companies offering this service has decreased, meaning there's now only one player in the game, Hala. Light music and a glossy promo is more like an ad for a last-minute holiday. It's actually a Hala advert for border crossings, and it looks easy and straightforward in this video from before the war. Palestinians in Gaza have long been used to paying fees to expedite their travel across the border. Hala has been the dominant player in this industry since 2019, when it began offering its VIP service, as shown in this video. We found a Facebook page with Hala employees offering advice. We spoke to one whose name we've redacted. We asked how much it was to leave Gaza for an adult and child. They came back to us, $5,000. We asked if they worked for Hala and how we would transfer the money. They said they did and told us we could pay by mobile cash transfer and send a relative to their headquarters in Cairo. We then asked if they lived in Cairo. And crucially, how could we be safe in the knowledge this wasn't a scam? They said they'd send us a photo of the ticket. We asked how long it would take to get names on the list. From 1 to 10 days, they said. This is what a travel ticket looks like, as provided by the employee as proof of their wares. So this Hala employee has told us that if you want guaranteed exit from Rafah, they are the people to go to. They told us to go to their offices in Nasser City in Cairo. Well, this is what people find when they do go. Hundreds queuing outside Hala's Cairo offices for a chance to get their loved ones on a future travel list. Multiple sources told Sky News there are often hundreds or even thousands of people queuing. And two sources said they were forced to pay a non-refundable $1,000 deposit simply to get into the building. Based on social media posts and the testimony of dozens of people who've arranged travel with Hala since October the 7th, Sky News was able to piece together a clear picture of how the company operates. Tickets used to cost in the region of $350, around £280 before the war. But Hala price lists show people are now looking at $5,000 per person to guarantee a way out, and $2,500 for children. Passenger lists are released daily, sometimes pictures taken of paper sheets posted on social media. On average, 235 people travel a day. Some passengers with Egyptian nationality pay a lower fare. But Sky News' analysis of Hala crossing lists and prices shows that on a day with few Egyptian passengers, the company can earn in excess of $1 million.
Well, well done, Sky News, putting that report together. Thanks for Vanessa Bailey for tipping this show off about it. And it's not just that. I noticed the Middle East Eye has just done a report on the Israel-Palestine war. They're saying war on Gaza. Charity says Egypt intelligence-linked firm is charging $5,000 to get aid over the border. The NGO provided Middle East Eye with first testimony that indicates Egyptian officials are profiteering from the genocide in Gaza. An international charity with extensive experience in providing emergency aid in wars, famines and earthquakes throughout the Middle East and Afghanistan is being forced to pay £5,000 per lorry in a company linked to Egypt's General Intelligence Service, the GIS, to get aid into Gaza. The charity said the money is being paid in the form of a management fee to a company affiliated with the Soris of Sinai, a construction and contracting firm owned by the Sinai businessman Ibrahim Al-Organi. So Martin, this is pretty appalling, isn't it? I mean, you know, the idea that suddenly, because we can control the border, hey, there's more demand for people to get across the border, so let's jack the price up.
If I can just intercept one other little thing there. I was listening to a doctor who'd been, he was an American doctor who'd been working in Gaza, and he said that they have to pay the money, the charities that they're working for have to pay the money for them to come out to.
So when you're donating to one of the Palestine charities or medical charities, that money may be going straight into Ibrahim Al-Organi's bank account in Egypt.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this kind of war profiteering is sadly not unusual. It's the sort
when,
of thing that goes on.
When people say no one wants a war, obviously Ibrahim al-Afghani does.
Well, that's right. And, of course, it's writ even larger when we're talking about Raytheon and British Aerospace and all these other people are breaking it in. And, of course, that means the people, the shareholders of these companies, which are the great and the good. I bet Rishi's got a few shares in all of that stuff.
Indeed.
And when Theresa May agreed to carry out attacks from Akrotiri in Cyprus into Syria, yeah, after the so-called Douma chemical weapons attack has been largely debunked by serious investigation. Her husband is a hedge fund manager, and he, because he, you know, they had some pillow talk the night before it happened, he made some moves on the stock market that morning and made a killing. Because, of course, if you know that the British are going to attack Syria and that's going to affect the price of Raytheon shares, you can buy some shares before the price goes up and sell them and make a bit of money, which is exactly what he did.
Who made the money just after the 7th of October attacks? Somebody
did make money, didn't they? They bet. You know, you can tell that something's going on when it was in Israel. It was in Israel itself, wasn't it? People actually bet on companies which either went down or up, and it was, you know, you can, and therefore that implies foreknowledge of the attack, does it not?
Mm.
As has happened in many of these incidents, which then goes to show there's more to going on here than meets the eye. Can I just make one point about UNRWA before we move on? What is that? What that involves is taxpayers like me in Britain and around the world, in France and everywhere else that funds UNRWA. We are funding the Israelis to drive the Palestinians off their own land, and then they've been put into camps in Jordan and in Syria, and we are then paying to keep those. And the Israelis don't pay a penny towards any of this. We pay for their mess.
Yeah,
and I think Nigel Farage needs to be told about this. Why is British taxpayers' money being spent in this way? Huh? So that the Israelis can go on the rampage.
Because in terms of the people who are occupied in Gaza and West Bank, they are actually meant to be completely funded by Israel. I don't know, once the refugees outside the country, I don't know whether that's true.
Well,
certainly if they're occupied, they're meant to pay all of the expenses, the living expenses. But it means that
they're in a position to switch it all off, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And of course they do, if it suits them.
Let's just be clear about the stock trading around the 7th of October. What you would probably just call insider dealing, bets against the value of Israeli companies, this is CNN, spiked in the days before the October the 7th Hamas attacks, suggesting traders may have had advanced knowledge of the terror attack and profited off of it, according to research released. This preliminary research from law professors at Columbia University and New York University details a significant and unusual spike 5 days before the attacks in short selling, the most popular fund linked to Israeli companies. Short selling is a way to bet against the value or security.
Mm. Well, that's right. I mean, this implies, I mean, we've been discussing this week after week, and of course this is what knocked this Labour candidate out of the Rochdale by-election.
By the way,
was
the
in
Israelis,
a private conversation talking about
let's
this.
Let's be balanced here, because claims traders profited from attack are inaccurate, says Israel.
Well, they do say things like that, don't they? And they're very good at just the Hasbara, you know, psychological warfare aspect of what the Israelis do, is you'd think that they would just give up on telling fibs, but they don't. Because in actual fact, if you tell enough fibs, it has an impact. You know, a fib, like we just deny it all, is good enough to keep most people quiet. And of course, unless you've got the time and the inclination to unpick it all, it works very well. That's why they do it.
Absolutely, it does.
Airdropped aid has crushed 5 to death in Gaza. So this great idea of dropping aid from aircraft, which I was quite an advocate of, obviously it's got to be done carefully and properly, but no, apparently the aid from parachutes from aircraft was dropped on top of people and killed 5 of them. And also the port in Gaza for aid. What do you make of that, Judith, this concept of having a port on the Mediterranean to bring aid into Gaza?
Well, why not? I mean, it's absolutely illogical that Gaza doesn't have its own airport and port. It did have paid for by the EU when they were saying that they were going to give Palestine independence, and it was going to be Gaza and Jericho first. So why shouldn't it have its own port? It's illogical that it doesn't.
The only thing is, of course, it might be US and Israeli controlled aid. And we saw with the flour massacre last week what can happen. Yeah. If the Israelis are left in control of the aid, then they sort of, basically, this is almost like a trap. So here's the aid, everybody. And as people start to gather, they wait until the highest concentration of Palestinians are there, and then they open up with machine guns.
Up and shoot them. I know. It's just appalling. So. And then apparently, they say that ordinary Israeli citizens, I've seen films of it, are actually stopping aid from entering Gaza through places like the Eretz crossing as well, so it's not getting in because it's being obstructed by Israeli citizens.
Netanyahu apparently is vowing to invade Rafah. He's rejecting all international pressure to do so. Another report, Israel has set March the 15th as a deadline for its broad war against Lebanon. So I don't know if he's got enough troops, enough soldiers to do both at the same time. Maybe he has, Martin.
I think what they're playing for there is to drag the Americans in to support them, and then we'll join along as well. Yeah, that's the whole idea. If they can extend the war, the right wing in Israel want the war extended so that they won't have to fight on their own. The Americans will have to come in and help them out. And of course, if the Americans go in and help them out, that means we are already helping them out. The Royal Air Force is flying from Akrotiri. I looked this up the other day. I thought they must be flying over Israel. But in actual fact, the Egyptians are allowing British aircraft to overfly Egypt. But of course, that won't be necessarily very popular amongst the Egyptian population. I mean, one of the things that might happen here, if Sisi is overthrown, that the Egyptian army might intervene against the Israelis. They're a big army. They've got the proper kit.
But
they could probably knock them back.
But they're very pro-Israeli. Well,
yes, I know the Egyptian military.
They're pro-US.
But
surely,
that's not necessarily the people in the country, is
no,
it?
No, not the people in the country. But I know that when we were taking aid to Gaza on a convoy, we went through Libya. Then when we got to Egypt, although we'd got permission to travel, the soldiers at the gate didn't let us through. They said, well, you've been given permission by the government. The government aren't here. We are, and we're not letting you through. So I think the military has been quite indoctrinated.
You're welcome to stay with us for a little while to talk about Ukraine if you want. That's up to you. Would you like to or not?
Incredibly up
well,
on
in which
Ukraine,
case, so, why not just tell us about you're apparently starting a Substack next
yes,
week.
Yes, I am. Yes,
everyone's doing this now.
Yeah, everyone's starting a Substack. I've got eyesight problems, so I've got a PA coming to help me with starting up the Substack, and so it's going to be called the Control of Information, Judith's Substack, the Control of Information. So I'm going to be hopefully publishing all of the research that I've done on fact checking, not only for this subject, for a whole load of subjects, and hopefully that will start going out next week.
Okay, well, Judith Brown, thanks ever so much for joining us once more. It would just be called the Control of Information.
The Control of Information.
So I can't put a link up to it yet, folks, but anyway, so thanks for all your help, particularly on the fact checking stuff, because I think for most of us, we have no idea who these fact checkers are. Sometimes a big kind of screen appears on your social media and it says, oh, these facts here have been checked. Are you sure you really want to have a look at this?
Yes.
And of course, this normally means that someone is trying to stop you finding out what's going on.
Exactly.
Anyway, Martin, the first thing we're going to look at with Ukraine is the British.
Thanks very much for having
thanks,
me.
Thanks, Judith. Is 10,000 British drones going to Ukraine?
I didn't see that. 10,000 British drones. Well, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, we're in for a penny, in for a pound, aren't we, on this?
What do you... Because a lot of this is... The idea is that they're running out of Ukrainians.
Well, they are running out of Ukrainians who are of
but a
military
little robot,
age and
a little
so
battery-powered robot.
Well, the drone war has been relatively even compared to everything else. So Ukrainians have been able to use first-person view drones And also, of course,
what's
got
that?
These,
a first person, what's that?
It's what we call an FPV drone, first person view drone. In other words, a little drone that somebody's flying as if they were in a computer game. Yeah. They're sitting on a console, moving it around, looking for, you know, and that has actually been one of the interesting things, if you're interested in these things about the Ukraine war, is how important this kind of low level modern technology has become. Because a first-person view drone can knock out a tank.
Okay, we've got a couple of stories.
Tanks
to do
cost
with
millions
Ukraine.
And millions of dollars.
First of all, a Russian warship has been destroyed. It was only launched in 2022 this week. But first, let's hear about Zelensky giving a speech in Odessa, only to find that the Russians are blowing up buildings around him.
Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis was on a mission to show his country's support for Ukraine on a tour of the port city of Odessa. But the leader got a taste of war firsthand when a Russian drone hit a target just a few hundred meters away.
We heard some sirens, and shortly after, as we were getting into our cars, we heard a big explosion. I think that for us, this is the best, most vivid reminder that there is a real war going on here. Every day there is war, which not only affects the front line, it affects our innocent fellow citizens.
Russia says Wednesday's deadly strike hit a hangar housing Ukrainian naval drones. It's the latest attack on Kyiv's infrastructure on the Black Sea. It suffered a surge in Russian strikes since Moscow withdrew from a UN-brokered deal last July that allowed the safe passage of Ukrainian grain shipments via the Black Sea. Russia claims Kyiv did its own damage on Wednesday. The governor of the Russian border region of Kerch says a Ukrainian drone attacked a fuel depot there.
Today, another attack on the Kerch region was carried out by Ukraine. A drone attacked a fuel and lubricants warehouse. There are fires in the area right now. Operational services have rushed to the scene.
In the northern region of Kharkiv, residents scrambled to pull a woman out from under rubble in the village of Borova after it was hit by a Russian bomb, killing one person. The attacks come as the Ukrainian army continues to struggle to hold Russian forces back on the front line. A top Ukrainian commander vows that the situation on the battlefield will stabilize soon. He says the army aims to form units to carry out counter-offensive actions later this year.
So, yeah, that's an Al Jazeera report on the bombing in Odessa. So this is the Russians saying... sending a message really to the press and to the Greek Prime Minister and to Zelensky.
Well, the Russians themselves deny that they were targeting Zelensky as such. But, I mean, you can make of that what you will.
Well, of course, I think it's obvious that they knew he was there. They knew he was giving a talk. He probably watching him on the TV and saying, well, let's at least show him that we, you know, we could kill him any time we want to, I guess.
Well, I think that's been true all along. The Russians have generally taken the view that they're not going to kill the political leadership of the people they're fighting because they may have to talk to them. You know, the problem with killing the political leadership of the people you're fighting is then who are you going to talk to? But they've responded to what they would regard as terrorist attacks on Russian territory, like the drone attacks on Belgrade, which killed loads of, a bunch of civilians, by attacking military infrastructure. This is why the Russians have insisted this is a special military operation, not a war. Because in a war, they'd just go all out and kill the other side up without mercy. But they're not doing that. They're going strictly for military targets. And, of course, some civilians are inevitably caught up in that. But they're not deliberately targeting civilians or the political leadership. The military leadership, they are targeting. And, of course, the heads, they've hit the SBU headquarters in Kyiv. So, you know, there's still an escalation ladder here, which the Russians aren't going up.
Now, you any idea how big the Russian Black Sea fleet is?
Well, I don't know the exact details. It's their biggest.
It's around 45 ships.
Yeah.
All warships. Now, we've had is the total so far is 14 of those have been destroyed, and 15 of them are damaged. So as these... news websites do, they have these horrid headlines, but they're not talking about the number that have been destroyed. They're still saying the Russian Black Sea fleet is shrinking, but it's still dangerous. There are still 30 ships active.
Well, I mean, Tony Radkin, who's the head of the British Armed Forces, is an admiral. He's head of the Royal Navy as well. He's staying on for another year so that he can coordinate with the Ukrainians. And, of course, these Storm Shadow missiles, which are sinking these ships, are being, they're being fired by British personnel, as Schultz, you know, the German Chancellor, letter, you saw that the intercept between the German generals talking about using tourist missiles to hit the Kerch Bridge, and Schultz was saying in public, we're not going to have our tourist missiles in there because then German personnel would have to be firing them, and we don't want to go down that road. But the generals are then over, you know, basically they got the Russians intercepted the phone call where they're talking about how they can use tourist missiles, but they'd have to use German personnel. A lot of these high-level NATO missiles that have been used in Ukraine are not being fired by Ukrainians because the Ukrainians don't know how to use them. So in other words, British military personnel are firing those missiles.
Last week we had, I think it was on Tuesday, a Russian railway bridge blown up in Russia, and on the next day it's a Russian warship sunk. Let's have a listen just to the report on the sinking of the warship.
Ukraine says it's destroyed another Russian warship in the Black Sea. Now, a Ukrainian military spokesman said the patrol boat had previously been targeted but was blown up overnight by maritime drones in the Kerch Strait near Crimea. The attack follows the launching of 22 Russian drones targeting the Ukrainian port of Odessa. Let's get more on this from Rob McBride, who's standing by for us in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. About the Russian Black Fleet, Sea Fleet, that's on patrol, what more do we know about the damage that the Ukrainian sea drones are doing?
Yeah, this does seem to be another claimed success by Ukrainian forces against the Russian Navy and against the Black Sea Fleet in particular. This patrol ship, it's been identified as the Sergei Kurtov. According to the Ukrainians, it was attacked in the early hours, still in darkness, when it was located in the Kerch Strait, which is just to the eastern end of the Crimean Peninsula. According to footage on Russian social media that purportedly shows the attack, we see and hear machine gun fire, presumably coming from the warship as it's trying to fend off the drone or drones, followed by a large explosion. And footage that's now been released by the Ukrainian intelligence seems to show the same attack again with a large explosion, but from the point of view, it seems, of a camera on board one of the drones in this attack. The Ukrainians have been making large advances in their drone technology in recent times. They've been becoming more powerful, extending the range of hundreds of kilometers, which has meant that the Russian Black Sea Fleet has had to limit its areas of operation away from the western northern parts of the Black Sea, more to the more protected eastern parts, but still clearly within range of these developing drones. What's also worrying from a Russian perspective, this is one of its newest warships. It's fairly small, only a crew of 80, but it came into service only in 2022. And like other warships in the Black Sea, new or old, it doesn't seem to have an answer to these Ukrainian drones.
So that's another Al Jazeera report on these drone attacks. They are obviously this is the main thing, and Britain is now sending another 10,000 of these.
Well, I hope that people listening to this show who live in the British Isles realize that at some point the Russians are going to fight back. If British military personnel and weaponry is being used to sink Russian ships which kill Russian sailors, then the Russians at some point are going to kill some British sailors, just to remind you that war is war. Now, if you want to get involved in that, off you go, but you'll have to live with the consequences. And I think lots of people in this country still believe that we can provoke the Russians in the way we have been over the last 10 years and that nothing will happen to us. Russia is not that far away. It's much nearer, much closer to us than our great friends, the United States. It's closer to us than Israel. And we think that we can provoke them and nothing will happen. One of the things that's happened, of course, is that we're no longer allowed to fish in the Barents Sea, which means that price of fish in this country, cod mainly, is going through the roof, because British trawlers which have fished there since the 1950s aren't allowed to fish there anymore. And that's just a minor irritation compared to what will happen if the Russians really decide to give us a bloody nose because of what we're doing to them.
I mean, they seem to be prepared to suck it up. Why is that so much?
They're prepared to suck it up because they don't want to escalate unless they have to. I understand that the people running the Black Sea Fleet, the two admirals have been removed, and they're bringing a third guy in whose name I can't remember. I was reading about it this morning. It is difficult for the Russians because, of course, they could easily start shooting back at the British and American ships.
They could easily do this.
Knock down the AWACS, which are creating all. You see all of the Ukrainians are fighting entirely.
They could knock down satellites. I think actually this is probably what they'll do: is they will go for things which don't actually kill people.
Well, what they will do is they will find the way of showing the British, if you carry on doing this, accidents can happen. And they'll probably try and play it in such a way that they send a message to Tony Radkin not to get involved in this, or it might be the worst for you.
I don't know.
Rather than shouting from the rooftops.
Heard of Lithuanian Foreign Minister Gabrielis Landsbergis, he's expressed concerns over the West's response to Russia's war in Ukraine, likening the current situation to the prelude of a significant event like Pearl Harbor during World War II. According to a report by, what is that? LRT, whoever they are, I suppose that's a Lithuanian broadcasters. Landsbergis believes that the West is yet to fully acknowledge the gravity of the Russian-Ukrainian conflict and its implications. He argues that most Western countries are downplaying the war as a regional issue. This perception, he suggests, is due to a fear of escalation and results in a lack of adequate support for Ukraine. He emphasized this approach is a significant political problem, hinting at the need for a wake-up call similar to the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941.
Well, we've had all of these politicians in the West, like Macron, saying that we're probably going to have to send our troops to the Ukraine.
Well, we know,
and then various other countries saying, no, 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 we can't do that. But the fact is, NATO troops are in. A figure I've said is there are 10,000 Polish young men have already died in the Ukraine, fighting as volunteers in the Ukrainian army. Now,
and what about British Special Forces? Well, they've been doing training and operating these Storm Shadow missiles.
That's right, they have. And of course, that's not really Special Forces, but yes. And of course,
these are the people Rishi Sunak is talking about, the forces in the UK trying to tear us apart. They are the people directing our Special Forces to try and start World War III with Russia.
Well, I would agree with that. But of course, unlike on Gaza, you've still got a consensus within the mainstream, within the Overton window in British politics, that the Ukrainian cause is just. Even if they're losing, it's a just cause. It isn't a just cause. The people in the East Ukraine are not Ukrainian. They think of themselves as Russians. They never identified as Ukrainians. And there's no particular reason why they should be forced into a Ukrainian state that they don't want to belong to. More than Kosovans want to be part of Serbia. And we went to war about that.
Let's leave the last word, because we are actually going to talk a little bit about the budget before we close again. To Mike Prisoner, he's around about 2005. He's a US soldier who spoke out against the wars that were being conducted as part of the war on terror, particularly the attack on Iraq. So Mike Prisoner now, that's Prysner, Mike Prisoner, Prisoner, maybe. And this is bear in mind the sacrifice, burning himself, basically, self-immolation by Aaron
Bushnell
last week. So let's have a listen to, I suppose, precursor to that, and during the time of the Iraq War, Mike Prisoner.
Susan Brothers, thanks everyone for being here. We're from the organization March Forward, and we're here to say to all those serving in the Army and the Marines and the Air Force and the Navy that you have the absolute right to refuse to take part in these criminal wars, and that's a right that all of you should exercise. You have no reason to go put your life on the line and kill and die for profit. We've been to Iraq, we've been to Afghanistan, and we know what these wars are really about. And we joined the military for many reasons. Because we need a college education. Because we need a job. Because we need health care. And then we join the military, and they tell us that our enemies are poor people in caves in Afghanistan or poor people in the deserts of Iraq. But we've been to those countries, and we know that our enemies are not other poor people abroad. Our enemies are the people that laid us off from our jobs, that denied us health care, that make it impossible to get an education. Our enemies are not in the poorest countries on the planet, but right here in the richest one. Now these wars, the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan alone, are costing over $700 million every single day. This is a crime. Every single day, while so many of us are hurting, while I think all of us here and the vast majority of people in this country would agree that we can spend $700 million a day better than bombing people that we have no reason to bomb. We can spend $700 million a day rebuilding those countries we've destroyed. We can spend $700 million a day caring for the veterans we get home when they get home. And then we can spend $700 million a day giving every single person health care, a college education, a job, and a livelihood, and a home. That's what we need to be spending our money on. But this government is not going to do that. They're not going to use the money in that way. They're not going to end the wars. And they're not going to do it because it's not our government. It's their government. It's a government of the rich. It's a government of Wall Street, of the oil giants, of the defense contractors. It's their government, and the only language that they understand is shutting down business as usual. And that's what we're doing here today, and we're going to continue to do until these wars are over. Well, it's crystal clear now that these wars are going to continue and expand and go into other countries. That is the trend. That is what we know, that there is perpetual war, and it's only going to stop if the people stand up and stop it. And that's what we're going to do, sisters and brothers. And a lot of people ask me, what do we do? Because we all know things are bad. We all see the atrocities on TV. We read about it. We experience it. People always ask, what do I do? Because we always want to know what to do. Do we vote? Do we support a politician? Do we join an organization? What do we do? Well, I'll tell you what we do. It's simple. We fight. We fight and we fight and we fight and we shut down our workplaces. We shut down our schools. We shut down the streets. We shut down business as usual. And we fight until we force the people in there to do what the people out here want. Because that's how we're going to get around, and we're going to fight until there's not one more bomb dropped, not one more bullet fired, not one more soldier coming home in a wheelchair, not one more family slaughtered, not one more day of U.S. imperialism. So let's fight to make that happen. We can do it today, and then the days ahead, we have to fight to end these wars and create a better world, sisters and brothers. So join us in that fight. Thanks.
A little round of applause for Mike Prisoner there, speaking at the time of the Iraq war. But Martin, the fact is that Palestine Action, people like that, are actually in this country doing this. They are closing down some of the factories, at least causing trouble for them.
Yes, and there's all sorts of different things people can do. Sometimes people do feel powerless because, you know, it seems like a juggernaut that nobody can stop. Everybody can do a little bit of something.
It's
just a little bit of something,
money,
and everybody does a little bit of something.
Shoveling money into the pockets of
bigger.
Ibrahim Organi is rather disappointing to hear, that people who are trying to donate to get aid to Gaza are funding him.
Well, you should give your aid. If you want to give aid, you've got to choose your organisations carefully, and you've got to also understand that some compromises will have to be made. I used to be an aid worker. And sometimes you have to make compromises to get the aid through. You don't really have to.
It seems
with
to be much more sensible
to
take action here somehow in the UK.
Well, yes, of course. And the other thing is that we shouldn't be needing to send aid to Palestine. It should be rebuilding itself as an independent state and sorting their own problems out.
I mean, you seem to be more of a fan of King Charles than I am. You think he's not quite so involved in all these things. But there has been a fantastic series, by the way, on Channel 4 Monday evening. Called Investigating Diana. I think it's carrying on for another couple of weeks. It's a repeat from a couple of years ago, but it's one of the best documentaries I've seen. A lot of it focusing on the French side of the investigation. And obviously, the French were a little bit less controlled about the way they saw it all than the British establishment over here.
Mohammed wanted as many investigations as he could get because he wanted the answers, and he wanted as many different people to be asking the questions as possible. Because that is the way you get to the truth. The turning point was when Richard Tomlinson, former MI6 spy, turns up in Paris to tell the French inquiry that he has seen the plans for an assassination plot when he was at MI6 in a tunnel using motorcyclists and bright lights and so on. Mohammed came rushing into the office and he said to me, you know, God has answered my prayers. Here is a man telling the story that this is what I think happened.
When the accident first happened, it didn't really occur to me that it was in any way related, but what made me realise very, very strongly was the witness report that there was a very bright light in the tunnel. And as soon as I heard that, that made me click two and two things together. But the combination of the bright light and the tunnel made me think straight away, well, maybe it wasn't an accident.
Mohammed was ecstatic. I have to say, I shared his joy, because it all sounded to me so totally credible.
So that's the series on Channel 4 at the moment, repeated from 2022, Investigating Diana, don't miss it, on a Monday evening. Martin, the point here is, if King Charles is prepared to be involved in the death of Diana, his wife, he's going to think that other deaths in other parts of the world are just kind of normal, isn't he?
Well, even if Diana was assassinated, it doesn't necessarily mean that he was directly involved, I'll make that point. And I believe she was assassinated, but I don't think he was necessarily directly involved. And of course, he is who he is. He's got connected. I mean, he's obviously been
What do you mean by that? He is who he is.
He is very pro-Israeli, for example. We know he is. He was a friend of Jonathan Sachs. He's not spoken out about what's happening in Gaza.
Let's put it more simply. An outspoken, a sort of medieval-style king, that he's not interested in the idea of taking a step back from it all and allowing the elected politicians to get on with it and only intervening where necessary. He's got a very, very clear vision of where he wants the country to go, and he's quite clearly in favour of... In fact, in the Queen's speech, or the King's speech that he gave last year, he immediately talked about Hamas as a terrorist organisation.
That's government policy. That's a fundamental.
He didn't have to do that, did he?
No, he did, because it's in the Queen's. It's in the King's speech. It's written by Rishi Sunak.
So Rishi Sunak writes that, you think?
No, it's only Hamas only became a terrorist organisation and a banned organisation in this country relatively recently, and in actual fact, that's a fundamental problem, because Hamas are the elected government of Palestine, and in Syria they were fighting alongside the Free Syrian Army, who were also trained by our special forces, against the Syrian Arab Army, and when they were fighting against the Syrian army, they were heroes and war fighting freedom fighters. But now they're fighting their traditional Israeli enemies. They are terrorists.
Well, let's have
it's exactly the same people.
Let's have a listen and go over the other side of the Atlantic. Look at the guy who's supposed to be in charge of the other side. Well, Rishi Sunak's supposed to be in charge here. My view is that people around King Charles are far more powerful than making so many of these appointments. Over in the States, we've had a bit of a mess up by Joe Biden. Here he is. Have a listen to what he says here about trying to get aid into Gaza.
The loss of life is heartbreaking. People are so desperate that innocent people got caught in a terrible war, unable to feed their families, and you saw the response when they tried to get aid in. And we need to do more, and the United States will do more. In the coming days, we're going to join with our friends in Jordan and others in providing airdrops of additional food and supplies into Ukraine, and seek to continue to open up other avenues into Ukraine, including the possibility of a marine corridor to deliver large amounts of humanitarian assistance. In addition to expanding deliveries by land, as I said, we're gonna insist that Israel facilitate more trucks and more routes to get more and more people the help they need. No excuses, because the truth is, aid flowing to Gaza is nowhere nearly enough. Now, it's nowhere nearly enough.
So there he is, twice mistaking Gaza for Ukraine, and actually saying the words, the Jordanians are going to help us get aid into Ukraine.
Yeah, well, that just shows that his cognitive difficulties. Trump can string a sentence together, but he's 100% behind the right wing in Israel. 100%. So if he takes over in November, or it will be January by the time he takes over, there is nothing to hope for there.
Well, I think it illustrates is that actually Biden is not in charge of anything.
No, not Trump won't be in charge either.
Not even his own mouth. So he gave last night the State of the Union address. So here are some key moments. Well, I suppose this is what they call key moments from that State of the Union address in front of Congress, I believe. I'm not sure if it's both houses in the States, but it's a political speech by the president in front of the elected senators.
Good evening. If I were smart, I'd go home now. I say this to Congress. We have to stand up to Putin. Send me a bipartisan national security bill. History is literally watching. History is watching. If the United States walks away, it will put Ukraine at risk. Europe is at risk. The free world will be at risk, emboldening others to do what they wish to do us harm. My message to President Putin, who I've known for a long time, is simple. We will not walk away. We will not bow down. I will not bow down. In a literal sense, history is watching. History is watching. Lincoln Riley, an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal. That's right. But how many of the thousands of people being killed by illegals? To her parents, I say, my heart goes out to you, having lost children myself. I understand. I know it may not look like it, but I've been around a while. When you get to be my age, certain things become clearer than ever. I know the American story. Again and again, I've seen the contest between competing forces and the battle for the soul of our nation. Between those who want to pull America back to the past and those who want to move America into the future. My lifetime has taught me to embrace freedom and democracy. A future based on core values that have defined America. Honesty, decency, dignity, equality. To respect everyone. To give everyone a fair shot. To give hate no safe harbor. Now other people my age see it differently. The American story of resentment, revenge, and retribution. That's not me. And Israel must do its part. Israel must allow more aid into Gaza to ensure humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire. And they're announcing they're going to have a crossing in northern Gaza. To the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority.
Now, so far as I know, there aren't any aid workers caught in the crossfire. They've been being killed by Israel, not by us.
Well, that's right. So there's a level of hypocrisy developing now where the West is trying, Cameron, Biden, they're trying to sort of wriggle out of the responsibility for what's happened and try to suggest that they do really, really, really care about Palestinian children who are dying and being starved. But it's pretty pathetic if you think about what they've, you know, there are still planes flying from Akrotiri in Cyprus, a British base, which nobody in Cyprus wants to be there. It's there because we made them have it. And we're using that base to supply weaponry to the Israelis to carry on killing children at the same time as weeping crocodile tears.
Let's get back to Biden, though. I mean, he's saying, I will not bow down. We were joking, I will not fall over. But the point is, he's saying we will give hate no safe harbour. But he's trying to start World War III. I mean, these people are, they're talking out of both sides of their mouth at the same time, aren't they? And this is one of the major problems, and one that's causing so much division, is the fact that they're saying one thing and doing the opposite all the time.
Well, that's right. I mean, they are criminals and hypocrites, and of course, this is widely becoming understood around the world. I mean, all of the bullying that went on over what was happening in Ukraine, you know, everybody's got to put sanctions on Russia, etc., although nobody did, apart from the American vassals in Western Europe, Australia and New Zealand. Nobody else put any sanctions on because they couldn't see that it was justified. But at the same time, then they turn around and we see what's happening in Gaza, and not only the Americans not intervening, and they could easily intervene, they could just pick... But Biden, if he was a different kind of president, like JFK, for example, could pick up the phone and say, you've got to stop doing that right now or we're going to cut off your pocket money. We're going to ground you. And they'd have to stop. But he's not doing it. Is he?
No, and I think actually a similar message could come from the UK. But anyway, like a penultimate section, we're going to look at the budget again now. Back to, we had a little brief chat about it, but I did speak earlier this week to the Workers' Party's Chris Williamson about what sort of budget he would like to have presented rather than Jeremy Hunt. So Chris Williamson is a former Labour MP who was actually removed by Jeremy Corbyn. You know, there's that famous article that Jeremy Corbyn treated his enemies better than his friends. Well, Chris Williamson was a friend of his, very much pro-Palestine, pro-Gaza, and Corbyn presided over him being removed from the Labour Party. So here's Chris and the Workers' Party, Galloway's party's take on the budget 2024.
I'll be announcing a plan to eliminate poverty in the lifetime of a parliament, although we're nearly at the end of this parliament, but certainly that's something I think that we could be doing. So I think there would be a big increase in the social security budget, in order to alleviate the grotesque levels of poverty that we have in this country. I would also be announcing a big public housing drive to address the housing crisis that we have in the country. You know, people sleeping rough and people living in insanitary accommodation and so on. I'd also be announcing a big increase in the minimum wage as well to go alongside the big increase in social security payments. I think they would be the kind of things that would make a huge difference to people. And if you wanted me to go on, I would be bringing in measures to restrict the ability of the utilities to charge the fees that they do, and also start set in train the process to bring these utilities and rail industry, etc., back into public ownership. Essentially, what we need to do is put the state at the centre of creating a good society. The states have enormous powers at their disposal, and particularly in Britain, because of status as a currency issuing nation. Unlike in Europe, of course, where they've gone into the eurozone, and so in essentially what the nations of the that are in the eurozone in the European Union, they've been relegated to the status of a local authority where they're not in control of their own destiny, you know, and because they can't issue their own currency anymore. That was one good thing that Gordon Brown did when he kept us out of the euro. So, but I think that'd be my three sort of top priorities. But there's so much wrong with the country, God, you know, you could go on all night.
So that's Chris Williamson there talking to me earlier this week. There's a longer version of that. I'll be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So running through his little, it's the money on social services, that is to say the welfare payments, much more money going to that. Also money going to up on the minimum wage, and also public housing, Martin. So social security, public housing, minimum wage, that's his three main things.
Yeah, well, obviously the minimum wage doesn't necessarily cost the government any money. They can decide to raise the minimum wage, and it's the bosses who have to pay it. Well, I mean, I've got nothing to disagree with there, and I think he's right that by not being in the euro, Britain does have more flexibility than it would otherwise have. But you'll also find that we wouldn't be allowed to do that. If we tried to do it, then lots of forces would immediately gang up on us.
Are you talking about like they do a Liz Truss on us?
Well,
they did to Liz
Truss.
Well,
no, Liz Truss did.
Are you talking about the City of London?
I'm not just talking about the City of London. I'm talking about
what forces are you talking about?
Well, for example, there was an anonymous general who said when Jeremy Corbyn was the leader of the Labour Party, we will not allow him to come to power.
Do you think there might be a coup?
If
Chris Williamson and his party managed to get amazingly a majority, and they were presenting their budget, and they said they wanted to have social security, more money for that, more money for public housing, and upping the minimum wage, that there would be a coup.
Well, it might be. I'm just saying. They don't presume that you can just do what you want, because you can't.
Well, you'd have to include some increase in the military wages as well, then you might
well,
not have
no,
a
no, you wouldn't necessarily. It's not a question of the ordinary grunts in the army deciding they don't like the government. It's the high-ups who are in constant communication with our American overlords.
Okay, well, Steve Hall, who we spoke to last week, also asked him about the budget.
First of all, we should be talking about massive public investment in productivity, levering ourselves onto the cutting edge of the new green, some people are calling it the fourth industrial revolution. We need clean energy. There's a debate about whether it should be nuclear, whether it should be borium reactors or uranium reactors, wind power, some the vestiges of fossil fuel that we might need to cope with the problems of nuclear power throttling up and throttling down. All of these things need to be talked about, discussed seriously. Start with energy, start with rail, start with infrastructure, start with business startups. All of these things need to be funded by government. We could even, in the interim, offer a job guarantee, as some of the heterodox economists suggest. There are so many things we could do, and we need absolutely massive public investment, and we don't have to borrow for this public investment. It's not about borrowing. Bonds aren't about borrowing. Bond money, where does it go? It goes into savings accounts when we pay back later with interest, but so in 30, 40 years' time. We don't use that money. That's simply to set overnight interest rates, to give the government some control of interest rates. All of the money we invest comes from a consolidated fund. Now, this is dismissed as money printing, which is a sort of demonic term, as if that's going to cause massive inflation. Well, it didn't after World War II. It did. It's not in the United States of America at the moment. They're growing the economy, and it's not inflating. Inflation, of course, as we know, was caused by price rises, supply shortages during the COVID incident. And you know, most inflation is cost push.
It seems to me that is going to be driving inflation up. By putting interest rates up, not down, and we were being told the opposite.
Which essentially is what it does, and it makes mortgages more expensive, makes rents more expensive. It makes borrowing, I mean, all businesses are running on credit all the time. They're borrowing just to keep going. There's also huge consumer credit. And don't forget, there's this huge disconnect between the base rate and the amount of money, the amount of interest charged by banks, credit card companies. I mean, that's a market. That's a market outside of the base rate. And they're operating a cartel. Those borrowing rates could be far cheaper, but they operate a cartel to make sure those rates. And you get ridiculous, you know, things like the Prudential way of paying 40% APR. It's crazy. What we need, of course, at a lower interest rate, I would operate a zero interest rate policy at the central bank, which means you don't need bonds to sell to set the overnight interest rate. And I would make that the baseline, and the market has to compete at a much lower level, which would bring down the costs of borrowing. Bring down the costs of borrowing, mortgages are cheaper, gives people more disposable income, therefore aggregate demand goes up. And therefore, if we invest in production to meet that demand, we won't cause inflation. But if we don't do that, then we will get inflation. So it's all about productivity. It's about investment. It's again about bringing the economy back to health. There are ways to do this. But one thing gets in the way, and that is that the private investors who are connected to mass media, who have got politicians in their pockets, don't want public investment to crowd out their private investment. They're against public investment because it's taking their business away from them.
I rather like the way Steve Hall explains this stuff so clearly. What do you make of what he's saying there, though, Martin?
Well, I mean, I would broadly agree with that. When he's referring to crowding out investment, when I was studying economics many years ago, the theory was that if you have too much public investment, it crowds out the private sector. And this is a bad thing because ultimately it's very inefficient and the private sector is more efficient. Now, this is simply wrong, and I'm sure he would agree with me if he was here on the studio, because in actual fact, public investment actually makes private investment profitable. Yeah, that's why Britain, you know, from 1945 to the mid-1970s, Western European and US capitalism worked rather well, is because there was no nonsense about not having a public sector.
What we get again and again from people like Rachel Reeves, and by the way, it was weird to see that it was Keir Starmer that responded to Jeremy Hunt on Wednesday, on Budget Day. I was expecting to see Rachel Reeves pop up, but no, apparently they've decided that Keir Starmer is the right public relations person to do it. But surely it should be the Shadow Chancellor that responds to the Chancellor, not leader of the Labour Party. Anyway, one of the things that Steve talks about there is this whole idea of it's not really like, as Rachel Reeves always says, oh, it's just like, you know, I learnt about money around the table with my mum borrowing and using money on the credit card and this sort of thing. Apparently it's nothing like that, Martin, is it? And that banks just make up money out of nowhere.
No, it isn't. I was quite annoyed with Rachel Reeves for using that metaphor, and Yanis Varoufakis wrote an article in The Guardian mocking her, really, because it just shows, I mean, what she's doing, she used to work for the Bank of England, she's quite intelligent, she should know that in actual fact we've got to knock this on the head, the idea that there is no money. There is a massive amount of magic money trees out there. The question is, what are you going to spend the magic money tree money on? And of course, what we do with our magic money tree money is we subsidise war, we subsidise all the things that we shouldn't be subsidising. But the idea that you can't, you know, if you could raise taxes on the wealthy, that's perfectly feasible if you wanted to. But you can also just print the money. And if you get a bit of inflation as a result of that, that actually takes the money off the wealthy without them being able to do anything much about it, which is why they hated the successful era of capitalism.
In the longer version,
because the inflation actually took the nest eggs away from the people who got nest eggs.
In the longer version of that interview with Steve Hall there, he talks a bit about Ben Bernanke and how he actually confesses and he says it. And so I dug out that clip. And so here's Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, talking about when they want to lend money to a bank, they simply use a computer to mark up the size of the bank account. There's absolutely no debt or whatever. Hang on, I suppose it is debt, but it's not.
That's the problem.
This is just clicking a button on a computer. You're making this money up out of nowhere.
Is that tax money that the Fed is spending?
It's not tax money. The banks have accounts with the Fed, much the same way that you have an account in a commercial bank. So to lend to a bank, we simply use the computer to mark up the size of the account that they have with the Fed. So it's much more akin, although not exactly the same, but it's much more akin to printing money than it is to borrowing.
So then there's Ben Bernanke spelling it out like it is. He's saying basically it's just the press of a button creating millions of dollars for a bank that then lends that out at interest.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, what we've done is by design, we've given over the creation of money to the private bankers. But there's no reason for that. The private bankers are very politically powerful, and they have, you know, that's what, you know, the Federal Reserve is run by them and gives them free money, which they then lend on to others as a profit. And also, of course, they then decide what things they want and what things they don't want.
I know it's a bit of a cheeky question, but could I ask you what you would do if you had the job of Jeremy Hunt? We got some interesting bits and bobs there, particularly really useful from Chris Williamson, giving us his three main things, including, of course, starting the process of moving these utilities back into public ownership. But what would you do?
Well, I wouldn't disagree with the general direction of travel that they are proposing. I would suggest, though, that the problem you're going to have, we should be telling people we need massive public investment. People eventually will face up to the fact that is the only way to get out of a major capitalist crisis is public investment. Now, you've got to then say, well, where's that coming from? You say, well, we're going to have to raise taxes on wealthy people. Things like land taxes, property taxes. Property taxes are very good to collect because the piece of property can't run away. And you could also say to people, they've abolished non-dom status.
You know what they'll do? What they'll do is they will take that property and they'll sell it, and then they'll put the money abroad that you can't get your hands on.
Okay, I was just going to say, in the budget, as a way of stealing Labour's clothes, Jeremy Hunt is going to abolish non-dom status. Like Rishi Sunak's wife, who's a billionaire, didn't have to pay any tax in this country because, in theory, she lives in India. So, but you could easily tighten that up. And you could also say to other wealthy people, we think you owe so much tax. And you say you don't. You say you live in Belize. I would say to these people, the former chair of the Conservative Party, you will live in Belize because we're going to take your citizenship.
I asked Chris the awkward question about how you get money off of wealthy people who've got squirreled it away abroad. And do you know what he said?
I said, who?
Do you know what he said? Have a guess.
Who are we talking about?
Chris Williamson. I asked him about how do you get money off of people who've squirreled it away abroad. And he said, well, you have a look at where these places are. They're mostly controlled by the British Crown.
They are indeed. And so it's a quite straightforward thing for Britain
to do. You have to have a word with King Charles.
Yes, I know. But what would happen if the British government decided to tighten up on all these British dependencies is that the dirty money would flow to other places. But what you can easily do, and it's quite straightforward, is you could change the taxation system. So instead of having a profits tax, you have a turnover tax. So somebody like Google has got a massive industry, massive amount of money going through the British. You say, well, we think you owe that much money. You say that you've only got a certain amount of profit and you've shown it all in Dublin. We think you've got a lot more profit. And the government could have civil servants assessing how much turnover they've got. And then you charge them. And they could argue back and they say, no, we think you owe this much. That's what you do with companies. With individuals, it's even more straightforward. You say, if you say you do not live in Britain and therefore you don't have to pay the tax, then you will not live in Britain. Now, if you go, but you won't come back.
Yeah, anyway,
and any property that you have in Britain, we will seize it.
One
just as all of Russia's foreign reserves have just been seized. Just like that. Bang, $300 billion.
One thing's for sure. Yes, that's
you can
right.
Do stuff
they
like
want
that.
To transfer it to Ukraine as well. Well, indeed,
anyway, but it just shows that it can be done if you want to do it. Especially if we're all going to war, which they keep going on about, have the other side of their mouth, you know. They want to say, well, we're going to have a much more prosperous future with more millionaires, more billionaires, more entrepreneurs, but also we're also going to have a war, which will involve sacrifice.
Okay, we've got a couple more items before we finish. One is look at Rudolf Hess and that flight, an interview I did this week with John Harris, the author. And finally, a bit about Jerusalem. Is it the idea to make it the capital of a one world government? But as we're finishing with the finance, Patrizia Opulenza this week has an ode, Punch, Crunch, Drunk Judy, the budget. On Hunt's red case, Queen's face did see. Working through the night, said he, a photo op in darkened room, Hunt lit up, all bathed in gloom. Proud as Punch, Hunt then did trip through the budget. What a clip! Crumbs he threw to save the bacon, already burnt, our lives forsaken. Perhaps increase of tax could add to capital gains. An idea, not bad. VAT reduced, 'tis now high time. Why is this seen by Hunt as a crime? A soup of words, Hunt punched his way, wild staring eyes to have his say. Rishi next to Powell did sit, smirking broadly he's done his bit. Destroy our country from inside out, unelected, a weffy snout. Smarma, satin, greasy suit, hair like glue, red nose to boot. A snifter, smarma, perhaps air taken. Medicinal to stop from quaking. Disdain on face when budget heard, crunching numbers quite absurd. R. Reeves in corner, perhaps told sit, while Smarmy Starmer says his bit. Starmer's voice like zippy sounds, bleating on, no truth e'er found. Reeves in suit like undertaker, a voice so dull, another faker. Money funneled out for war, no mention of this cut we saw. Pre-Convid and the years since then, our wealth all stolen. 'Tis us and them. A soup of words on the budget railed, empty sounds from mouths exhaled. Between each cheek of reds and blues, bruising folks, punch bags, abuse, laughing loud, all up their sleeves, a coup d'etat, GB, to knees. Through troubled waters, no matter now, the globalists our land hath ploughed. Reeves and Starmer in a stew, no compromise, 'tis clearly true. Smarmer, drunk. On power, 'tis clear, the Labour Party no longer steer. A farce played out in Westminster Sea, bludgeoned lives don't hide their glee. Coffers emptied, 'tis no surprise, stripped our land, now privatised. No matter how, who stands in power, lies deceit on us will shower. Two sides, same coin, cheap silver-plated, GB our land, through sieve, has grated, carved it up the spoils of dust. GB, come hell, or high water, is bust. Thank you very much, Patricia Opulenza. Martin, before we hear the clip about Rudolf Hess this week, what do you make of that trip that he made in 1941, just before the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union?
Well,
he flew to Britain. Didn't
he claims he claimed to be, you know, the official record is that he came to Britain to negotiate the potential entente between the German regime and the British, so that they could, you know, so that they could, you know, there was no reason for the British Empire and the Germans to fight. You know, we'll deal with the Russians for you. We'll deal with the Soviets for you. What about it? And of course, you know, it didn't go anywhere.
Do you think it was ever going to be a coup here, or some sort of change in policy if Hess arrived?
Well, I think what happened was there was a big fight within the British establishment about what the policy towards Hitler was going to be. And don't forget, as we know, the Pinay Circle and so on, lots of people very deep into the establishment were quite keen on Hitler and didn't regard him as a threat to Britain at all.
But
even after
May,
1940.
This is May 1941, yeah. After the Blitz had begun and was happening every day, pretty much, or every night. And we were well into the war by this stage.
Yes, but of course the possibility of stopping a war, even when you're well into it, is always there. It's there in the Ukraine and it's there in Palestine.
I mean,
but are we going to? The answer is probably not.
Okay, well, I'll tell you my own view after we've heard from John Harris.
We believe he was heading for RAF Dundonald, which is a controversial statement because it was an operational RAF base just beneath Glasgow. Why do we think RAF Dundonald? Well, number of reasons. Number one, it's marked by inference on the flight map that Hess brought with him. Number two, it was a quiet RAF base. It had just recently been emptied of navigational students. So on that Saturday, there weren't many people about. And thirdly, it was under the direct operational command, again, of the Duke of Hamilton. So that's why we believe Dundonald was the intended target. But as far as Rudolf Hess was concerned, the BF-110 was a huge plane. It was twin-engined. In my farming career, I've got some tractors which are typically about 100 horsepower each, and they're quite substantial machines. The Hess plane had 2,000 horsepower engines, 10 times the size of my tractor engine. So they were pretty huge, and they were supping fuel at the rate of around 660 litres per hour. So that's where the timings come in to importance, because he took off at 5:45, crashed at 7 minutes past 11. That's roughly 5 hours, 24 minutes. And a Messerschmitt 110 held just short of 1,300 litres of fuel in its tanks. And so consequently, it could only typically fly for around about 2 hours. So there's been a lot of speculation in the past that, oh, well, it couldn't have been the Hess plane because he couldn't have carried enough fuel. Ostensibly, that is, of course, the case. But what Hess had got, in addition to the fuel tanks in the wing, was twin auxiliary fuel tanks. And the Luftwaffe supplied those in 900-litre sizes. It's quite a lot of evidence to support the fact that Hess had got 2 900-litre fuel tanks. That meant that he'd got circa 3,000 litres of fuel on board when he took off. So as far as fuel was concerned, he hadn't got a problem. He'd got sufficient fuel to make the flight that we know took place. However, where life gets somewhat more interesting is that the Messerschmitt 110 had two huge Daimler-Benz 601 engines, as I've said, and they were of a dry sump design, which meant that oil was actually utilised, not recycled. So it would use oil at a rate of between 7 and 9 litres per hour. And behind each of these huge engines were a 35-litre oil tank. So simple mathematics means that if the engines were using oil at 9 litres per hour, then the plane could only fly for 4 hours, which we know it supposedly flew for 5 hours 24 minutes. So it's the oil which is the interesting issue. And the Luftwaffe obviously had thought of that too. So it also had an auxiliary oil tank option that could be fitted. And the radio operator in the plane would pump the oil through to the engine tank from the auxiliary tank. Unfortunately, in the Hess affair, there was no radio operator. So consequently, there was nobody to pump any oil. And in the fuselage, which still resides at Duxford to this day, there is no auxiliary oil tank either. Instead, there's a big brass nut that is wired in place. So Hess certainly did not have an auxiliary oil tank. And that then, this is quite old information. We've probably discussed this before, Tony. Because there was no auxiliary oil tank fitted, Hess could not have flown for 5 hours 24 minutes without his engine seizing through loss of oil. And it's that basic fact that has driven us to do more work, and we now are absolutely convinced that he landed en route at a place called Gießen in northern Germany, refueled and re-oiled, and that then enabled him to take off again with sufficient fuel and oil to land and fly as he did to Lowland Scotland. From Gießen, he flew up the North Sea at an angle of 335 degrees. How do we know that? That's on a map that the ploughman that arrested him on landing tore from his knee. And that was a navigational chart that we were sent a copy of years ago. And then the issue becomes when to turn left, as you quite rightly say, between the Edinburgh air defences and the Newcastle air defences. And it's at that point that the flight began to unravel. When Hess wrote years later to his wife, who lived in Bavaria after the war, from his prison cell in Spandau in Berlin, he bemoaned the fact that at the decisive moment, as he called it, i.e. when to turn left, his radio compass failed him. And we take that to mean that he lost contact with the radio navigation system. And so consequently, he didn't know for sure when to turn left.
Yeah, well, that's a little bit awkward, isn't it? Imagine you're flying up in the evening up the North Sea, right up the middle of the North Sea, and you've got to turn left, land in Scotland, and then all of a sudden your radio navigation equipment goes blank. So maybe the Germans had switched off the towers. Maybe that's because they weren't doing a raid that night, but maybe it's because they knew exactly where Hess was and they were trying to cause trouble for him. So anyway, that we do discuss that in the longer interview, and I'll probably have another clip from that next week. But the two books that John has just brought out are, one is Conspiracy, Calamity and Cover-Up, John Harris, about the Hess flight, and the other one is called The Rudolf Hess Flight Book, which looks at the various radio navigation aids that Hess was using. But the point really here is, and John and I disagree about this, but we have very polite conversations about it, about whether or not there really was any chance of Hess in being involved in some kind of armistice between Nazi Germany and Britain in May 1941. It looks to me, was a very clever ruse by MI6, and we do talk about this in the longer interview, and Tancred Brennius, who was the for the Nazi ambassador, or not, sorry, he was a Finnish ambassador to Nazi Germany, and also in touch with MI6, persuading Hess that there was a real chance of all this happening, and that there was a big faction in Britain that was against Churchill, and that all he needed to do was come over and everything would be wonderful. But there's another motive here for MI6, is they were one by one, including later on in the war, Reinhard Heydrich. What they were doing was making sure that the people who'd been friends with Hitler, and Hitler saw Heydrich, for example, as his successor, that these people were either murdered or spun out of the way from Hitler's inner circle by MI6 in different fashions, this just being Hess just being one of them, in order to leave Martin Bormann as the most influential Nazi very close to Adolf Hitler in the last years of the Second World War. So anyway, I'll put the full interview with John Harris up on our show page about the Hess flight and his new books on that topic at thisweek.org.uk. And we finished this week with David Sorensen, who's brought out a film. He does a website, or he's part of a website called Stop World Control. And this is a film just out, literally the last few weeks, about what he calls the Zionist plan to create a one world government based in Jerusalem.
So this is the mystery of Israel that has been solved. It has nothing to do with what the ancient scriptures say about what Israel is. It is diametrically the opposite of that. It was founded and financed by blatant Satanists who have an agenda for world domination, and who want to have the support of the billions of Christians from around the world so that they can succeed in their agenda. I understand that it's extremely shocking if you hear this for the first time, but all this information can be researched. You can find more and more evidence for this when you do your due diligence. I want to invite you to become part of building a better world, where we don't support entities that create war and murder hundreds of thousands and even millions of people. We are not here to make this world a place of horror and terror and fear and destruction. We are here to bring love, justice and goodness amongst all of humanity. This is our purpose. That's why this film was made, to expose an extremely nefarious agenda. Their plan is to incite world war, so that they can use that as an excuse for establishing a one world government, which would then supposedly bring peace. We have the choice to fall into this trap or to open our eyes and have the courage to stand up for what is right and prevent their agenda.
So that is his name anyway is David Sorensen. It's stopworldcontrol.com is where he resides, and that's certainly his view, is that the idea is that Jerusalem will keep going, and that the plan is to make that the center of a world government. And the idea, of course, is ordo ab chaos, create massive amounts of chaos, a third world war, and to bring peace based in Jerusalem out of it all. Well, this almost seems to be a kind of upside down version of God's plan for mankind, but that's what you'd expect, I suppose, from these accelerationists and Armageddonists, isn't it? So time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guests, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, Bristol's Green councillor for Central Ward, Annie Stafford Townsend, also of course to Judith Brown, Dr. Judith Brown, who's a Yemen expert and a fact checker and just about to start her information control Substack, as well of course as Bristol freelance journalist Joe Banks, and to sound engineer Dave Bazanko, and particularly also, of course, to Patrizia Opulenza, our poet, resident poet. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please share their interviews and story tips. And you can always get a sort of main direction on any of these things from the Not the BCFM Politics Show page. You'll find there the podcast, the full-length interviews, which you can also very easily access on the app. Not the BCFM Politics Show app, and story links, the comment page, and our email addresses. You can also subscribe to my weekly newsletter there, and you can even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. My paperbacks are available. That's The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers, and also The Siege of Heaven Reader. They're both via www.bilderberg.org. This show's repeated 11 p.m. Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, that is, here at talkradio.org.uk, and also Sunday breakfast at Camberley's Radio Q UK. com. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and the radioquk.com and Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
You always make me smile when I'm feeling down. You give me such a vibe, I just totally bona fide. It's not the way you walk, and it ain't the way you talk. It ain't the job you got that keeps me satisfied. You love me so.
you, mister. Told me I got what it takes. She said I'll turn you on, son, into something strong. Play the song with the foggy break. Engelgard Mozart was checking out the weather charts, see if it was safe outside. And little early birdie came by in his curly whirly and asked me if I needed a down, but she never got touched. She's gonna make it to the night. She's gonna make it through.
I'm not sure.
shot down, but you never got touch. It's gonna make it through.